You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, takes on the world news.
This is Jeff Blankford welcoming you to Takes on the World, a program on international affairs that comes your way the second and fourth Wednesdays of every month, and every other fifth Wednesday when I open the phones to get your takes on the world. It may have occurred to others, but I've yet to read or hear of anyone making comparisons between what has been happening at our border with Mexico these days and with the even more deadly conflict at Israel's border with Gaza since the early spring. While there are clearly many differences, there is one similarity which should not escape our notice. Both the situation of Palestinians under decades-long siege and blockade by Israel and Gaza, and that of the thousands fleeing to our border to escape the deadly violence in Honduras, Guatemala, and El Salvador, are arguably the results of the foreign policy and actions implemented by U.S. administrations over the last half century, regardless of which party controlled the White House and Congress. In Central America, it has been U.S. support for the corrupt and powerful, while in Gaza, it has been a longstanding policy of arming and backing the occupier while sanctioning the occupied without a single voice arising in Congress to challenge it. Gaza will be the subject about 20 minutes past the hour when I speak with Donald McIntyre, the former Jerusalem correspondent of the London Independent, whose recent history of the fabled strip along the Mediterranean, Gaza Preparing for Dawn, is by far the most comprehensive to date. Our discussion will come at a timely moment. Just 2 weeks ago, a bungled Israeli intelligence operation and an exchange of fire between Hamas and the Israeli military that followed came very close to initiating another one-sided attack by one of the world's most powerful armies and air forces against an imprisoned people that have neither or nothing beyond the ability of Hamas, Islamic Jihad, to launch a barrage of hand-fashioned low-power rockets. They are scary for those on the receiving end, but almost have to score a direct hit to cause any damage. As I reported on my last program, Egypt, the UN, Norway, and Switzerland helped achieve a ceasefire which led to the resignation of Israel's Defense Minister Avigdor Lieberman, who was eager for another slaughter. A threat by the ultra-right-wing Jewish Home Party to pull out of the government and force new elections if its head, Naftali Bennett, was not appointed in Lieberman's place, failed to materialize when Netanyahu refused and took over the defense portfolio himself. Thus far, the ceasefire is holding. What is also holding, and which you probably haven't heard about, is the hold Senator Rand Paul of Kentucky has put on U.S. military aid to Israel. Paul, who has previously called to cut the arms gifts of U.S. taxpayers to Israel, recently put a hold on the U.S.-Israel Security Alliance Authorization Act of 2018, which codifies into law the $38 billion arms package for Israel over 10 years that was negotiated in the final days of the Obama administration. A hold is a parliamentary procedure that allows senators to prevent a motion from reaching a floor vote. The Senate passed the act in early August, which you probably didn't hear about, and the House followed suit the following month. Before it goes to the White House, however, the Senate must pass a final version in line with the bill passed by the House. In order to bring pressure on Paul to change his mind, Israel's domestic lobby, the American Israel Public Affairs Committee, or AIPAC, has recently brought advertisements on Facebook identifying Paul as the main force blocking the act. At the same time, Christians United for Israel, CUFI, sent out an action alert email blast on Monday to its supporters, calling on them to flood Paul's office with calls and letters encouraging him to support the legislation. CUFI has also reportedly invested heavily in ads in Kentucky to target the senator's constituents directly on the issue. The $38 billion deal is the most generous ever to Israel. The act, awaiting the Senate vote, also expands a stockpile of weapons that the U.S. has maintained in Israel since the first U.S. war in Iraq, to which Israel has access in wartime and has resorted to in its wars on Gaza. The stockpile was seen at the time as an attempt by President George H.W. Bush to mollify the Israelis by keeping them from joining the war in Iraq after a Scud missile landed in Israel. The currently blocked act also reportedly enhances Israel's qualitative military edge over all of its adversaries in the region, real and imagined, which is required by U.S. law, and urges space research cooperation between Israel and the United States. No doubt a way will be found to change Senator Paul's mind, as occurred the last time he sought to block an arms package for Israel. Pro-Israel Jewish organizations worldwide are even more concerned by a decision by Airbnb not to list rentals in the occupied West Bank. Last Thursday, lawyers launched a class action lawsuit in Israel against a San Francisco-based company, accusing it of, quote, outrageous discrimination, quote, and demanding monetary damages after it withdrew listings in the illegal Jewish settlements. Airbnb said it was removing listings of around 200 homes in settlements after hearing criticism from people who, quote, believe companies should not profit on lands where people have been displaced, end quote. Exemplifying the meaning of chutzpah, speaking to our attorneys, Manit Rabinovich from the West Bank settlement of Kedah, who offers guest room rentals, said the move, quote, represents especially grave, offensive, and outrageous discrimination, end quote. The company's decision, affirmed her lawyers, is in effect directed solely against Israeli citizens living in the settlements, the petitioner claims, and this is severe, especially outrageous discrimination, part of the long war being conducted by organizations of which a clear majority are anti-Semitic, against the State of Israel in its entirety, and against Israelis living in settlements in particular, end quote. The Palestinian Arabs are not allowed to live or rent in the exclusively Jewish areas in the West Bank, as does not apparently, in their eyes, amount to discrimination, not outrageous or even mildly so. Israeli officials, as could be expected, reacted with anger to Airbnb's announcement, viewing as a concession to and a significant symbolic victory for the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement aimed at pressuring Israel on its treatment of Palestinians in the manner of a similar movement that targeted Israel's one-time ally, apartheid South Africa. Israeli Tourism Minister Yariv Levin said the, quote, miserable decision was shameful. A disgraceful surrender by the company, and ordered his office to develop measures to hinder Airbnb's activity in the country and put together a plan designed to encourage tourism in West Bank settlements. Flying in the face of fact and world opinion, Gilad Erdan, the Israeli government's point person for fighting the boycott movement, said in a radio interview that, quote, there is no distinction between this part or that part of the State of Israel, unquote. He compared his ministry's efforts to that of the Israeli army that continuously attacks terrorist organizations even though there are occasional attacks, unquote. He called on property owners to sue Airbnb, using Israel's law for prevention of damage to the State of Israel through boycott. Well, last Wednesday, representatives from Israel's Ministry of Strategic Affairs and the country's ministries of tourism, foreign affairs, justice, economy, and Israel's tax authority met in Jerusalem to discuss ways to overturn the company's decision, while Israeli Deputy Minister of Foreign Affairs Zippy Hatovli sent a letter to Airbnb protesting the move. Airbnb's announcement did not come out of the blue. The day before, New York-based Human Rights Watch was set to publish a report outlining the company's activities in Israeli settlements. Titled Bed and Breakfast on Stolen Land, the report provides information about 139 properties that Airbnb listed in Israeli settlements in the West Bank, not including East Jerusalem, in the spring of 2018. In a statement emailed to Reuters last Tuesday, Chris Lahan, Airbnb's global head of policy and communication, said, quote, Israel is a special place, and our over 22,000 hosts are special people who have welcomed hundreds of thousands of guests to Israel. We understand that this is a hard and complicated issue, and we appreciate everyone's perspective, end quote. From the Israeli perspective, the feeling is definitely not mutual. They are well aware that should Airbnb get away with delisting rentals in the West Bank, it would be the greatest victory yet for the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement, and set a dangerous precedent that other companies may choose to follow. A bemused opinion writer for Haaretz, David Rosenberg, noted that, quote, it won't even scratch the Israeli economy or even that of the settlements, but it did drive the government into hysterics, end quote. Joining in those hysterics, I expect, if Airbnb does not back down, will be members of Congress of both parties used to kissing Israel's behind, demanding penalties on the rental service for having done the right thing. If nothing else, the brutal murder of Jamal Khashoggi at the hands of the Saudi government may end up bringing an end to the U.S. support for Saudi's war in Yemen. and prevented a combined U.S.-Saudi-Israeli war on Iran, since making war is something that has come naturally to this country since its inception. I have been thinking a lot about that since reading a moving essay in the November 26th issue of Time by Vietnamese-American writer Viet Tran Nguyen, titled American Like Me, What It Feels to Love My Country No Matter How It Feels About Me, a brief section of which I have chosen to share with you. Speaking of the war in the land of his birth that would lead his parents to seek refuge in the U.S., he writes, quote, many Americans consider the war to be a noble, if possibly flawed, example of American good intentions. And while there is some truth to that, it was also simply a continuation of French colonization, a war that was racist and imperialist at its root and in its practices. As such, this war was just one manifestation of a centuries-long expansion of the American empire that began from its own colonial birth and ran through the frontier, the American West, Mexico, Hawaii, Guam, Puerto Rico, the Philippines, Japan, Korea, Vietnam, and now the Middle East. One war might be a mistake, he writes. A long series of wars is a pattern. Indians were the original terrorists in the American imagination. The genocide committed against them by white settlers is Thanksgiving ugly side, he writes, not quite remembered, but not really forgotten. Even in France, where images of a half-naked Native American in a feathered headdress can also be found. Centuries later, writes Viet Tran Nguyen, the latent memory of genocide or the celebration of conquest would surface when American GIs called hostile Vietnamese territory Indian country. Now Muslims are the new gooks, while terrorists are the new communists, since communists are no longer very threatening, and every society needs an other to define its boundaries and funnel its fears. Many Americans do not like to hear these things, he acknowledges. An American veteran of the war, an enlisted man, wrote me in rage after reading an essay of mine on the scars that Vietnamese refugees carried. Americans had sacrificed themselves for my country, my family, me, he said. I should be grateful. Another Vietnam vet, a former officer, now a doctor and dentist, more calmly, after beginning his autobiographical novel, The Sympathizer, but apparently not finishing it, suggested that if he liked the communists so much, he should go back to Vietnam and take his son with him. I was worried to not write back to him, writes Tran Nguyen. I should have. I would have pointed out that he must not have finished my novel since the last quarter indicts communism's failure in Vietnam. What Tran Nguyen reveals in his essay is something rare among Americans who have not traveled much nor had the experience of living in a foreign country and witnessed the impact that U.S. policies had on that country, for U.S. policies increasingly impact every country. It goes a long way in explaining the lack of understanding on the part of most Americans to the worldwide refugee crisis, of which U.S. wars and interventions have been the primary cause. This is the problem at the highest levels, as revealed in an op-ed in Monday's New York Times, co-authored by former Obama National Security Advisors Ben Rose and Jake Sullivan, entitled Fixing America's Image. And they said that Trump's Democrats should challenge the president on his approach to the forever war when it was something that he inherited from the Trump administration. There's another challenge looming on the horizon. It is the fate of WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange, holed up since 2012 in Ecuador's London embassy, who prior to the 2016 elections released some emails that exposed the duplicity of Hillary Clinton and those in the Democratic National Committee who are making sure she received the Democratic Party presidential nomination and not Bernie Sanders. Ecuador's new president, Lenin Moreno, has withdrawn the credentials of his UK ambassador, who has been at the center of negotiating the fate of the WikiLeaks co-founder, raising concerns for his safety. The decree with which Moreno effectively sacked Ecuador's London ambassador Abad Ortiz offered no explanation as to why Ortiz, who had been his country's ambassador to the UK since 2015, had been permanently recalled, nor did it name his successor. Abad, appointed to the office under President Rafael Correa, was the last diplomat Assange knew in the embassy. All diplomats known to Assange have now been transferred away from the embassy, the WikiLeaks site claimed. The sudden change in Assange's situation has led to the belief among his supporters that Moreno is doing Washington's bidding by removing people who might have stood by Assange and opposed his potential handover to the British police, which is expected to bring about a swift extradition to the U.S. His supporters are calling the new situation a, quote, a silent pro-U.S. coup. Should Assange, who arguably has done more to expose ugly truths about U.S. and foreign and domestic policies and that of other countries than anyone in my lifetime, be brought to the United States to stand trial for having revealed U.S. state secrets, as now seems likely, it will be a moment of truth for those who genuinely believe in a free media. This has been Jeff Blankford. Thanks for listening.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next.
This Week in Palestine.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, where each week you will hear the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian perspective, the Palestinian voice, exploring the realities of the Israeli occupation of the Palestinian homeland. You will not hear this narrative very often in the Western media, which is why it is so important that we present it each week on This Week in Palestine. This morning, we have a very unique and interesting feature presentation, which will take the entire time of This Week in Palestine this morning. You will not have heard this story before, at least not in this detail. We have a Palestinian scholar, Srimati Mitter, who has done an enormous amount of original research on the freezing of Arab-Palestinian bank accounts by Israel following their declaration of independence, and she's writing a book about it. Israel not only drove Palestinians off their land and took their homes in 1948, they also froze their money. She gave this talk in Washington, D.C., where she was introduced by Youssef Munayer.
I'm really looking forward to the presentation today. The title of the event is A History of Money in Palestine, The Case of the Frozen Bank Accounts of 1948. And when I first came across the topic and the topic of the research that will be presented here, I really was struck by the topic in general because despite all we hear about and talk about the narrative and the history of the events of 1948, so much of it is dominated by the loss of land and the expropriation of land and the acquisition of land and so on, and homes and everything that goes along with it. But rarely do we hear about the question here, which is the question of money, the question of bank accounts. And so what was the case of the frozen bank accounts of 1948? And we're very fortunate to have with us today Srimati Mitter, who has done research on this very question as part of her doctoral work, and is working on putting that into a book for publication. She is the Ernest May Fellow at Harvard University, and she'll discuss this episode in Palestinian history, which has never before been written about. She will use it as well as a prism through which to explore how the fact of statelessness, which is generally thought of as a political condition, directly affects the economic and monetary lives of ordinary people. She is, as I mentioned, working on a book based on this titled A History of Money in Palestine from the 1900s to the present. So please join me in welcoming Dr. Srimati Mitter.
Thank you so so much. It's really lovely to be here. It's an honor. Thank you, Yusuf. Yusuf's sort of given the whole game away. He's already explained my entire argument, so I might as well just make this very short and go home. But the story I'm going to tell you today begins on a particular date and with a particular event. On June 12th, 1948, the new government of the new state of Israel issued an order to all banks still operating within its territory to freeze the accounts of all their Arab-Palestinian customers and to stop all transactions on all Arab accounts. The Israeli government gave the banks 1 month to comply with this order and threatened to revoke the banking licenses of all those banks which were found to be in non-compliance with it. By December 1948, 6 months after the termination of the British Mandate for Palestine and 6 months after the formation of this new state of Israel, every single bank which was operating in Israeli territory had complied with this order. And thus, by December 1948, 6 months after the termination of the Mandate for Palestine, every single Arab-Palestinian who had had a bank account had lost access to the money and the valuables which they had kept for safekeeping in their banks. 6 months. How could this have happened? Why did the banks comply with this order when the protection of their customers' accounts and valuables and money is the principle most sacred to all banks? Why was the order issued in the first place? And what did the Arab-Palestinian customers do about it? In answering these questions, I'm going to take you through the story of the frozen bank accounts of 1948, and I'm going to use it to pose a larger question about what it means to be stateless. I'm going to suggest that the condition of statelessness, which is generally thought of as a political problem, and it's treated as such in all the literature on the subject, it's a question of political rights, legal rights, that sort of thing. What I'm going to suggest is that statelessness also has a very important economic dimension. And that's really what my work focuses on, what I really try to highlight in all my broader projects. So while I'm going to talk about this episode of the frozen funds of 1948 today, I'd like to take just a minute to talk about my book project in general so that you can put it in context. So as Yusuf mentioned, I start in the early 1900s. It's a historical work, and I start with the waning years of the Ottoman Empire. And I focus on what happened to the bank accounts and particularly the financial assets of the Palestinian people who were living in Palestine at the time, particularly during the moment of transition during the World War I years. That's where my book opens. I look at basically what happens to the money and the assets of the Palestinians when the Turkish government, of you know, which is at that point running Palestine, is basically issuing all these orders, ordering all the Palestinians to switch to a new Turkish paper currency. Palestinians at that point had been using silver and gold coins. During World War I, the Turkish government, sort of desperately trying to fight World War I, you know, basically issues all this paper currency. And I sort of, you know, focus on that moment in time, because that gets very much at this question that I'm, you know, really interested in, which is what happens to ordinary people, what happens to their economic and their financial lives during these moments of transition over which they have no control. So I start in the Ottoman period. My second chapter looks at the British Mandate period. The third chapter, which is really the central chapter of my work, is what I'll talk about today, which is 1948, and it's really the central transition in Palestinian history. Then I look at 1967, and then I look at 1993. And through all these moments of, you know, this big transition, when the state on the top is changing, I focus on two questions. What happened to people's economic and financial lives through these transitions? People had to go to work the next day, no matter what's happening, whether it's the Ottoman or the British or the Israelis or the Jordanians or the Egyptians or whoever's in charge. What happened to their economic behavior? What happened to their financial lives? And the second question is, what happened to their assets? Now I'll get back to this question of what happened in 1948, but I'm going to use these stories of what happened to their assets, what happened to their financial lives, to make two broad arguments about the economic dimensions of statelessness. And these are the arguments. The first is that stateless people, like the Palestinians, but not only the Palestinians, and that's a really important part of my work too, which is putting the Palestinians in context with stateless people everywhere. It's our tendency to think of Palestine and the Palestinians as a very sort of unique situation. And partly what I'm trying to show is it's not. This is what happens to stateless people everywhere. And this is because stateless people are particularly vulnerable to dispossession because they don't have the protection of sovereign banking institutions of their own. And that's the first reason why they're so vulnerable to this sort of dispossession. The second reason is because they don't have a sovereign legal regime of their own. So they can't go to law courts, as we'll see in this story. They can't go to a law court and say, well, the bank's taken my money. Can you help me? Because the law courts are siding with the entity, as we'll see in this case, which has ordered the confiscation of their assets in the first place. And the third reason is that stateless people like the Palestinians don't have a right to directly represent themselves at international fora such as the United Nations. They don't get a seat, in other words, at the table. They're represented by other people, the Jordanians or the Egyptians or the Arab League or whatever. There was no Palestinian seat at all these discussions at the UN at this moment in time. So for these three reasons, the lack of sovereign banking institutions, the lack of a sovereign legal regime, and the inability to directly represent themselves at international fora of diplomacy. For these three reasons, stateless people are particularly vulnerable to being dispossessed of their financial assets. And that is a central argument I'll make today, and is a central argument I make in all my work. But there's a second argument, no less important argument that I'll make today, and that I really want you to take away with you. And that is that despite this vulnerability to dispossession, the Palestinians in the story nevertheless really fought for their rights. And they use many strategies to, you know, fight for their rights. But one of the really surprising things that emerges from my research is the extent to which they turn to the law for the protection of their assets. And I'll tell you why I say this is surprising. You know, it's partly because, as Yusuf mentioned, you know, we hear a lot about 1948 and the dispossession of Palestinian land. We hear, you know, about the houses. We hear about the property. But no one, literally no one, talks about this question of the bank accounts. And then, you know, the reason why I was so surprised when I was doing my research is not only does nobody talk about the bank accounts, nobody talks about this story, which is that the Palestinians sued the banks. They turned to the law courts to fight for their rights. Now, and this sort of, in many ways, goes against the grain of Palestinian historiography of this period, which the general tendency is to present the Palestinians as victims. You know, they were steadfast, the Samoans, you know, they stood, you know, they tried to sort of be dignified, but they were victims. The central story is one of loss. Or we have other narratives. They were fighters, they were terrorists, they were guerrillas, they turned to arms, whatever word you want to use. We have those two narratives. They were victims or they were fighters. Nobody talks about, you know, yes, they were victims, and yes, they did fight, but they fought through law. And this fighting for law, this what historians call agency and what I'll call legal agency, is really an important conclusion of my work. And I'd really like you to take that away with you while keeping in mind, you know, the story of this greater loss. So these are the two arguments I'll make today. And without further ado, let me turn to the story of the frozen bank accounts. If you'd like, you can take a look at the handout, which I think all of you had, you know, just so that you get a sense of the speed and rush of events. I'll take you through this very, very quickly because I don't have much time. I'll begin the story in November 1947 because this is the date of the UN partition plan for Palestine. At this point in time, November 1947, fighting breaks out throughout the land of Palestine between Arab militias and Jewish militias. In February 1948, the British Mandate authorities declare their intention to terminate the mandate for Palestine without specifying what institution is going to take over, without saying anything about who's really going to take over this country of Palestine, without saying what's going to happen to anything. And, you know, very interestingly, saying that they don't say very much about anything, but the British do actually say the Palestinian currency, which had been the currency in place in Palestine for the last 20 years, is going to be folded up. So they do say that. They say almost nothing else about termination of the mandate for Palestine, but they do say there's no longer going to be a Palestine pound. That's in February 1948. Between February 1948 and May 1948, the land of Palestine is absolutely riven by fighting and by war. This is also when, as some of you might know, this is the start of the Palestinian refugee crisis. You have hundreds and thousands of people, you know, sort of fleeing their homes, in some cases being forced out, in some cases fleeing, literally just fleeing for their lives. The UN has estimated there were about 800,000 Arab Palestinians who fled, you know, between November 1947 and May 1948. And the Arab Palestinian population of Palestine in 1947 is 1 million. So if 800,000 people have fled, you can just imagine the massive displacement of people. That's all happening during this time. On May 14th, 1948, David Ben-Gurion declares the independence of the state of Israel, and a provisional new government of this new state of Israel is formed. That night itself, Arab armies invade Palestine, invade this new country of Israel. And so the fighting, which had already been widespread, becomes even more so at that point in May 1948. On June 11th, 1948, the first ceasefire is brokered between Jordan, Egypt, and Israel. June 11th. On June 12th, one day after that first ceasefire, the Israeli government issues that freeze order to all the banks to freeze the accounts of all the Arab-Palestinian customers. Now, which were the banks that were affected by this order on June 12, 1948? There were basically three banks at this point in time that had Arab-Palestinian customers. There were many banks in Palestine during the mandate period, but there were three banks which had Arab customers. So these were the three banks that were affected by the order. Two of the banks were large international commercial banks. It was Barclays Bank, which was a big British bank, and it was also the quasi-official bank of the British mandate government. At this point in time, June 1948, it is the largest bank in Palestine in terms of number of branches, number of account holders. And then there's the Ottoman Bank, which is also a very large international bank. As its name suggests, it used to be an Ottoman bank. It used to be, in fact, the quasi-official bank of the Ottoman government. But by this point in the story, in June 1948, it's actually been bought over by British and French interests. So it is a large commercial bank, in fact, headquartered in London by this point. So both Barclays and Ottoman banks have have Arab customers and Jewish customers and are therefore affected by this freeze order. And then there's a third bank, a smaller bank, called the Arab Bank, which is actually owned by an Arab-Palestinian, run by Arab-Palestinians, and has only Arab-Palestinian customers. So these are the three banks which are affected by the Israeli freeze order. And the freeze order is issued on June 12, 1948. And all it says is stop all transactions on all Arab accounts, freeze all Arab-Palestinian account holders. If you get a sense of what it meant to be a bank employee in one of these, you know, branches of Barclays or Ottoman Bank at this time, June 12, 1948, as I've said, you know, the country is absolutely riven by war. The management of the banks are usually British, but they've all been evacuated by this time. They've all fled to Cyprus by February 1948. People who are left in the branches are Arab and Jewish workers. They're clerks in the banks, both Arab and Jews. And they're sort of dealing with the situation of war. They're sort of deciding, well, should we go to work today? If we go to work, what do we do about our customers? What do we do about our Arab customers? What do we do about our Jewish customers? Do we separate the accounts? Do we keep them together? You know, what do we do about our bank branches where every day a window is being shattered because there's a bomb outside on the streets? So this is the situation in which this order arrives at their branches from this Israeli government. On June 12, 1948, the Israeli government has not been recognized by any international entity except the United States. So, you know, these branch managers in, you know, Jaffa branch, Jerusalem branch, they get this order and they absolutely don't know what to do about it. I was very, very lucky to be able to work in Barclays Bank archives in Withamshire in England. And I was able to see the correspondence that comes out of this period. I was able to see the letters that, you know, branch officials in Jerusalem, in Jaffa, in Acre, in Haifa were sending back to their managers in head office in London saying, we don't know what to do. We've got this order by this Israeli government and, you know, what should we do? And the response comes back from London, which is this sort of classic of bankerly sort of evasion of any sort of trouble. It is do nothing. Do nothing. Ignore the order. Do nothing. So between June 1948 and October 1948, that's exactly what happens. The banks, Barclays and Ottoman Bank, absolutely do nothing in the sense that they ignore this order. In fact, the Ottoman Bank's manager, he's actually a British man who has not been evacuated. He refuses to leave. He is a bit of a cowboy. He takes the entire Jerusalem branch, like all the safe and all the money that they had in, and all the vaults that they had in the Jerusalem branch. He puts it into a truck and he drives to Amman. And he basically just sort of starts operating the Jerusalem branch of the Ottoman Bank out of a truck in Amman. And he basically says, anybody who can come to my branch, this truck, I'm paying them out. You have to be able to come there. If you can't come there, I can't help you. But if you can come to Amman, I'm paying you out. So this sort of goes on in October. At the end of October 1948, the Israeli government catches wind of this, that none of the banks are actually obeying its order, that people are being paid out, and the banks are actually quite overrun with customers withdrawing their money at this time. The Israeli government is absolutely furious at having been defied in this way. What do? They revoke the trading license of the Ottoman Bank, as they had threatened to do in June. says you can no longer operate within Israel. You've lost your license. This is when the Ottoman bank's headquarters in London are like, oh my God, you know, we've lost our trading license in Israel. This is a very, very big part of our business. What are we doing? They issue a reprimand to this cowboy of a bank manager in Amman saying, stop paying out your customers. Stop paying out customers. Barclays Bank is watching what's happening with its colleagues in the Ottoman Bank and realizes that the Israeli government is actually serious about revoking trading licenses. So Barclays Bank, by October 1948, also stops paying out customers. Customers come to the bank, Arab customers come to the bank branches, and they're told, sorry, can't pay you out. We've been ordered by the Israeli government to freeze your accounts. That's in October 1948. In December 1948, there's a big turning point because the Israeli government in December issues these emergency proclamations, which are, you know, we know about them later because later in March 1950, they're codified into law. These are the famous absentee property legislations. But in December 1948, they're just called emergency regulations concerning the property of absentees. That's the terminology. And it is this emergency proclamations are given status in law. They're codified in law because they've been passed by the Knesset, the Israeli parliament. At that moment, when the military order of June 11th becomes a law on December 1948, that's when the banks really begin to obey. They say, as of December 1948, we have frozen all our Arab-Palestinian customers' accounts and we stopped all transactions on all Arab accounts in December 1948. February 1949, there's another turning point. The Israeli government issues a new order to all the banks, yet again, saying you can't just freeze the accounts, you can't just stop the transactions, you have to transfer all Arab accounts, everything, cash and valuables, so safety deposit boxes, over to a new branch of the Israeli government, which is called the Israeli Custodian of Absentee Property. Apotropos Shelnik Seinifkadim, for those of you who speak Hebrew. We've created this new bureaucracy and all the banks, you know, Ottoman and Barclays bank branches, have to transfer over all the accounts that have been since October frozen into this new bureaucracy. The banks, when they get this order, are actually quite relieved because in February 1949, what's happened is they're listing all these things on their books. They're still showing that they have all these account holders on their books. So they have this weird cash position on their books where they're showing they have these accounts, but they're not paying them out. They're frozen. And, you know, for those of you who know banking law and banking accounting rules, this is the worst nightmare for any bank, to have something on your books as a liability, but you can't actually serve that liability. In February 1949, when they're asked to basically transfer over all those accounts to the Israeli Custodian of Absentee Property, they're very happy to write checks because that means it resolves the cash position. The money is no longer on their books. It's gone over to the Israeli government. So in February 1949, Barclays Bank, Ottoman Bank, write checks, transferring all the accounts of all Arab-Palestinian customers to the Israeli Custodian of Absentee Property. And thus, in February 1949, the dispossession of the Palestinians is complete. Now I'll talk a bit about the Arab-Palestinian customers themselves. I'll talk about how they reacted to this moment of, you know, having their bank accounts frozen. Before I do that, let me talk a bit about how much money are we talking about so that you can think about who are these people who are affected by this order. Now, it's actually very, very difficult to get at the numbers. I did a lot of work in Barclays Bank archives. I worked a lot in the Israeli State archives and in British National archives. But it's actually quite difficult to get at exactly how much money was frozen. So the number I'm going to tell you is a number that I feel comfortable estimating, but it's not set in stone. So based on the sort of piecemeal archival evidence, you know, looking at Barclays' correspondence, looking at UN correspondence, looking at Israeli government correspondence, I feel comfortable saying that it was about £6 million that was frozen in 1948. This corresponds to 10,000 to 50,000 bank accounts. Now, that's a big range, 10,000 to 50,000, but that seems to be about right. On the low end, it's 10,000. On the high end, it's 50,000. Now, to put this number in some sort of context, 6 million Palestinian pounds in 1948 is about 43% of the total Palestinian exports in 1945. So total Arab and Jewish economy combined, total exports were about 14 million. In 1945. So this is about 43%. So it's a huge amount. It's not an insignificant amount. To put it in present value terms, what would the £6 million be worth today? Again, that's a very imprecise calculation. It's very, very difficult to get at the number. But it's about using World Bank's present value calculator. 6 million Palestinian pounds in 1948 is about £800 million pounds today. in 2013 terms. So it's not an insignificant amount of money. Now, who were these Arab Palestinians to whom these £6 million belong? Who were the account holders of these 10 to 50,000 bank accounts? I'm going to make an argument that they were ordinary people. They were ordinary people. They were neither the political elites, which has been the obsession of much of Palestinian historiography, nor were they the peasants, which has been the other obsession of Palestinian historiography. Now, we hear a lot about these two classes of people, the elites, the political ayan, or the peasants. We don't actually hear about the people in the middle who were neither of these two groups. And I'll tell you why I think these were the people, you know, who are concerned by this story. The political elites, well, financial elites, firstly, by June 1948 have actually left. They sort of read the writing on the wall and they'd left long by, you know, the freeze order is issued in June 1948. By then, you know, those who could had really left taking their money with them. So financial elites are out of the picture. Political elites who stayed, they didn't bank with the Barclays Bank or the Ottoman Bank because, they were nationalists. It was sort of impolitic to be banking with Barclays Bank if you're a Palestinian nationalist fighter fighting against the British. These people banked with the Arab Bank. Remember I told you there was a third bank in the story, and that was the Arab Bank. And the Arab Bank was actually founded by a Palestinian, Abdul Hamid Shoman, whose whole shtick was that we are a Palestinian nationalist bank. And if you're a Palestinian nationalist leader, you better bank with them and not with Barclays or Ottoman. And the Arab Bank refused, you know, to obey this freeze order. So political elites had their money in the Arab Bank. They were fine because the Arab Bank never obeyed the order. Financial elites have left. Peasants, vast majority of Palestinian population at this time, I don't think they would have had bank accounts. I have no proof for that, but I just don't think they would have been, you know, the customers of Barclays and Ottoman Bank. That leaves the people really largely in the middle, the people who are sort of the forgotten Palestinians in all this story. And, you know, all of this, you know, I don't want to make this too much of a class story because, you know, I couldn't come across, the bank wouldn't release the names of the customers or anything like that, but I could come across the range of the accounts, you know, how much money were, you know, was an individual account. And it's a wide range. There was an account of £50,000, which is huge in those days, but there's also accounts for £10. And, you know, one of the accounts I came across, you know, many of the accounts I came across were signed by thumbprints, not by signatures. So it gives you a sense of, you know, this is not overtly a middle-class story necessarily. There are illiterate people who, for whatever reason, would have banked with Barclays Bank. I'll just give you one example. I was very lucky to be able to work with the American Colonies Archives. For those of you who've been to the region, the American Colonies is a really fancy hotel in Jerusalem. At that point in time, it was a pilgrim guest house, and it employed many Palestinian Arab staff. And one of the Arab Palestinian staff was a cook, a cook by the name of Helwe, no last name. And she had been told by her bosses, who are all the American colonists, who are Scandinavian, American, whatever, church-going people, I think she'd been told by her, these people, you should put your money in a bank. That's how you keep your money safe. That's how you become modern. You don't give it to your dad. You don't give it to your husband. You open a bank account. We'll open it for you. We'll go with the Barclays Bank because that's where we bank. And so in Barclays Bank registers, I found an account for, it literally says, the maid Hilwe, signed by a thumbprint. And she had £10 in her account. And those £10 were frozen, which probably constituted her entire life savings. So this, just to give you a sense of the texture of, you know, who are these people whose bank accounts are frozen? It's not just middle-class rich people. It's not, you know, it isn't even just middle-class, you know, middle-class people. It's often these kinds of people. All right. So how did these people, these kinds of people, react to this experience of having their bank accounts frozen? I'll give you a couple of anecdotes so that you can get to the heart of this story. The first is a story of a man called Michel Karkar. Michel Karkar was in 1948 a boy aged 14. He came from the town of Lidda in central Palestine. And he, along with his family, were these famous Liddawis who went on this forced march. They were thrown out of their houses and made to march eastwards towards Ramallah. For those of you who've read this New York article that came out in October, it really talks about this story of this, you know, what happened to the Arab families of Lidda. Michel's father and his uncle were gold merchants. They weren't very rich. They were illiterate people, but they had a lot of cash on them because that's what they did. They were gold merchants. They were actual sarraf. They were money changers and gold merchants. So they had an account with the Ottoman Bank. Michel's father and uncle were killed in the course of that long march from Lidda to Ramallah in 1948. Michel was 14 years old, and he was the oldest boy in the family. When the family reached Ramallah, he realized that their situation was absolutely desperate. That the father and uncle have been killed, they have no money, they've literally just got their possessions on their back. And he was like, well, you know, I've got to step up. I've got to be the man here. 14-year-old boy. He marches into the Ottoman Bank's branch in Jerusalem, asks to see the branch manager, who till this day he remembers the branch manager's name. It's a Mr. Whitfield. And he says, you know, my father and my uncle have died. They have an account with the Ottoman Bank. It's £700. He knows exactly how much money they had. And I need it because my family is desperate. The Ottoman branch manager looks at this boy and he says, I'm really sorry, your money's there. This is before the money's been transferred in February. This is still in October 1948. Branch manager looks at this boy and says, I'm sorry, your money's there, but it's frozen. The word frozen in Arabic is mujammid. Michelle tells me the story recently. I've known him over the last few years. He's now an 80-something-year-old man who lives in Ramallah. This story happened 60 years ago when he was a boy of 14. He's told me the story over and over and over again. And each time he tells me the story, the details are so precise. He remembers it exactly. And he keeps telling me, Mujammid, Mujammid, Shumana, Mujammid. What is this word? You know, just the bafflement caused by that word and being told by the branch manager that your father's account is there. It's safe. We've got it. But you can't touch it. Mujammid, it's frozen. Michelle tells me, you know, it's quite funny. Every time he tells me the story, he always insists on one detail, and that is that he was wearing shorts when he went into the bank branch. He says, I was just a little boy, lapse pantalon, you know, I was wearing these shorts, you know, and he sort of starts shouting and screaming at the branch manager. The shock is so great. You know, he just starts crying and throwing a tantrum in the bank branch to the extent that the bank throws him out. That's Michelle's story. Just as you can get a sense of the trauma that this caused with this young boy of 14 years old who's lost his family. I'll tell you another story. This is a story of a man called Theodore Sarouf. Very different kind of story from Michelle. So Michelle's story, you can get a sense of the class background of this person. He's, you know, not necessarily illiterate, but not very wealthy. I'll tell you the story of a man called Theodore Sarouf, which is a very different kind of story. Theodore Sarouf was a young, swashbuckling entrepreneur in Jaffa. He was in his 20s. He was apparently very given to wearing beautiful clothes. He always used to wear white suits and a hat. You know, he was very, very sort of beautifully dressed man. And he was an entrepreneur. He was one of these class, you know, the first entrepreneurial class of Palestine who really flourished in the 20s and the 30s in the cities of Jaffa and Haifa and Jerusalem. And he established the first Arab advertising agency in Jaffa in 1927. This was called Sarouf's Advertising Agency. Theodore had a bank account with Barclays. He was a Jaffawi. Like many people from Jaffa, he actually fled to Beirut during the fighting, taking £200 with him. After the £200 had finished and he's, you know, he's in Beirut, realizes he can't go back to Jaffa, he walks into Barclays' branch and, you know, with his beautiful suit and his hat and all of that. And he says, you know, Barclays branch, please can I withdraw my money, the rest of my money that I have in my branch in Jaffa? And Barclays branch manager in Beirut looks at Theodore Sarouf and says, sorry, Mr. Sarouf, your money's there, but it's frozen. The exact same story. And Theodore had actually died by the time I was doing my research. This story is told to me by his son. His son told me that this was such a trauma in his father's life. No, his father was actually fine. Like a lot of these quite wealthy entrepreneurial people, he found his feet in Beirut. He had family. You know, he wasn't destitute or, you know, like many other Palestinians. He was okay. He built his life, you know, was fine. When he died, his son told me that they discovered that he had 27 different bank accounts in Beirut. Each one had a tiny amount of money squirreled away in it because he never trusted banks again. So these stories are just, you know, my book is actually full of these stories, and I really hope, you know, I hope I can write it firstly, and I hope, you know, that many of you will turn and read it. But this just gives you a sense of how the Palestinians, right, the trauma that this experience caused to these very different kinds of Palestinians. But, you know, it's not just a story of trauma. Palestinians didn't just, you know, sit and cry as Theodore's, you know, as Michel Karkar did. They actually, in this case, really fought for their rights. First, they started by writing letters to the banks, you know, and because I was able to work in the bank's archives, I was able to come across the, and the bank archives are full of these letters written by their customers, you know, making claims, not making political claims, not talking about Zionism, not talking about Israel. They're writing as customers to banks, saying, we are the customer of Barclays Bank, we're a customer of Ottoman Bank, we have a contract. I put my money for safekeeping in the bank, And you're supposed to release it whenever I come, you know. This is how banks work. And it's very interesting to read the wording of these letters, because it also gives us a sense of a clue of who are these customers of the banks. You know, these are people who really bought into that project of modernity that banks represent. I have a feeling their fathers and their grandfathers would have been the sort of people who put money in grounds and holes or holes in the wall in their houses. These people went with banks. So it really actually hurt the very people who believe most in this project of banks, in this project of modernity. These were the people who suffered most from this confiscation of their accounts. So they wrote all these letters saying, you know, release our money, how can you do this? You know, how can you be a bank, a British bank, and do this? The bank's response when it came, the banks always responded. They took their time to respond, but they did always respond. And the letters were, again, you know, this model of bankerly evasive language. And they sort of said that, you know, we're very sorry, we don't want to freeze your accounts, but we are obeying the laws. The laws are those of the State of Israel, and until we are allowed by the sovereign entity of the State of Israel to release your accounts, we can't do anything. Please know that you are a valued customer, and we really appreciate your business, and we hope you will continue banking with us, blah, 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 blah. You know, this every single letter sort of almost following this model of, you know, we can't do anything, our hands are tied, but we're very sorry. You know, this is a bad situation for us as well. So letter-writing campaign to the banks doesn't work. Palestinians then take it to the British government. They write to the British government. And I worked in the British National Archives in Kew in London. And I, you know, found a lot of letters written to British Foreign Office by Arab-Palestinian customers, again, making very similar claims, not making political claims, making a claim about what it means to be a customer of a British bank and saying, you know, as a British government, you should intervene and you should help us. And some of the letters are actually quite interesting because they employ this quite sort of flattering language. You know, they write to the British government saying, we know the British are the champions of the Arabs in Palestine. And can you, no mention of it. Israel. Can you please sort of write to the Barclays Bank and Ottoman Bank? Can you tell your country's banks to, you know, it's sort of that kind of language. The British government, you know, this is 1949 already, is really troubled by this whole thing, this episode of the Frozen, really embarrassed because it's British banks. They wouldn't care if it was an Egyptian bank or something. It's British banks, you know, British name, all of that. You know, many people in British Foreign Office at that point in time, and actually today, are obsessed with this idea of Britain's name in the world, Britain's reputation in the world. So British government is very, very divided. There are foreign office officials who feel they should lean on the banks and make the banks release the accounts. And there are people who feel in the British Foreign Office that it's really not Britain's place, that this is the matter of a sovereign country, which is Israel, and Britain can't intervene. And to give you some context, at this point, Britain and Israel have this very sort of awkward, uneasy relationship. The British and the Israelis and the Jordanians are at this point negotiating with each other on all the end of mandate stuff. So there's this whole vast machinery of the mandate government, which has just sort of been left, you know, sort of in flames. And there are all sorts of things, all sorts of odds and ends that need to be tied up. Things like, you know, who pays the pensions of the people who work for the British mandate official? What happens to the tables and chairs of all the, you know, what happens to the infrastructure of the mandate government? Who pays out the bond, coupons and things like that? So the British government is actually at this point in time undergoing these lengthy negotiations with the Israeli government, all this stuff. And they feel that they just can't bring up the frozen bank accounts because it would complicate matters too much. And the Israelis would say, as the Israelis did say, that this is a matter for us. This is our internal state sovereignty. What does Britain have to do with this? So what the British government eventually does officially is that they advise all the Arab Palestinians who are writing to them, take up this matter directly with the Israelis. As the Israelis have said, this is a matter for Israeli sovereignty. Take it up with them. And that's what, in fact, many Arab Palestinians do. I did some work in the Israeli state archives, and I found letters written in quite broken Hebrew. You can tell it's been translated from Arabic or English into Hebrew, written to David Ben-Gurion, you know, writing things very similar to the letters that have been written to the British government, saying, you know, not making any political claims, nothing, very carefully sort of saying, can you release our money? And, you know, one of the really interesting letters I found was a letter written from a Haifa merchant. You know, so this proves that it wasn't only the absentees, the people who left. It was also Haifa merchant, somebody who'd never left, whose money had been frozen. He's written in Hebrew to David Ben-Gurion saying, can you release my money? But of course, the Israeli government writes back saying, we're really sorry, we can't release the money because we're fighting a war with the Arabs, and when there's peace, we'll release the money. And this is sort of the Israeli rhetoric, which is, this is a wartime measure, and this is what countries do in times of war. The moment there's peace, we'll release the money. And we look forward to that and all of that. So writing to the Israelis doesn't go anywhere either. The UN gets involved from very early on in the story. This is actually a working group within the UNCCP. That's the UN Conciliation Committee for Palestine. That's actually created to deal with this, you know, bank accounts issue. But, you know, they, you know, just keep meeting all over the place, all the time, but nothing is resolved. Because it always comes up against this problem of the Israelis saying, until there's peace, we're not going to release the account. So by 1953, the Palestinians are absolutely fed up. They're fed up because nothing is working. The UN isn't helping. The British aren't helping. The banks aren't doing anything. And they finally decide to take matters into their own hands. What do? They sue. They decide to sue the banks. They know they can't sue the Israeli government, so they sue the banks. It's actually the Arab Bank. Remember I told you there was this third bank, the Arab Bank. It's actually the Arab Bank, which had a big account with Barclays Bank. Because, you know, Barclays Bank was the biggest bank during the mandate. So it was sort of like a central bank. So a lot of the smaller banks also had accounts with Barclays Bank. And the Arab Bank had £500,000 with the Barclays Bank, which had also been frozen. So the Arab Bank is actually the first Palestinian entity to sue a British bank. And they sue in the British courts in April 1953. And in fact, this lawsuit becomes a seminal lawsuit in banking history because it really becomes an interesting case of what are the rights and duties of banks to their customers in times of war. And the lawsuit goes all the way from the lower court all the way to the British House of Lords, which is the highest court in Britain. And at each stage of the case, the courts decide in Barclays' favor, saying that Barclays in this situation was right to freeze the account of the Arab Bank because an order had been issued to the banks, and banks are supposed to obey orders. Banks aren't supposed to opine on the legalities of anything. They're just supposed to obey the orders if the order is coming from a sovereign state. And that's why I started my talk by saying this has so much to do with statelessness, because it really revolves around this question of Israel's sovereign legal status in British courts. So a British lawsuit, you know, goes all the way to the British House of Lords, doesn't work out. Palestinians lose their case. There are two Palestinian lawyers watching the proceedings from afar, and they realize that that's exactly, you know, the problem, that the British courts are going to agree with the banks because the British courts are going to say that the Israeli order was, you know, was what was issued, and the banks have to obey the Israeli order. These two young Palestinian lawyers, Fuad and Aziz Shahadeh, they realize that if they can find a legal regime which is not going to recognize Israel, then they have a chance of winning. And that's exactly what they do. Barclays Bank and Ottoman Bank both have branches all over Jordan, you know, including Jerusalem, which is, you know, half under Jordanian rule. And they decide to find a group of Palestinian plaintiffs. They gather together 50 Arab Palestinians of varying, you know, class and background, and they file 50 different lawsuits on the same day in various different courts, Nablus, Jerusalem, Amman, against Barclays and Ottoman Bank at the same time. So Barclays management the next day wakes up and they find they have 50 different lawsuits that have been filed against them in 50 different courts in Jordan. The lawsuits take a very, very long time, you know, but in the end, the lawsuits go exactly as the lawyers had predicted. They go in the Palestinians' favor because the Jordanian courts, and, you know, it's the exact same question that the British courts were deciding on, which is should the banks have obeyed this order? And the Jordanian courts decided no. They said the banks should not have obeyed this order because the order was not issued by a sovereign entity. It was issued by an illegal entity, State of Israel, which is not recognized at this point by Jordanian courts. And so Barclays Bank and Ottoman Bank find themselves one fine morning in 1956 with 50 different lawsuits that have gone against them, ordering them to pay back their customers. But they've won the lawsuit in Britain. So they're in this weird position where they've won in Britain, they've lost in Jordan, they don't know what to do, and they're absolutely fed up at this point. So the Barclays and Ottoman Bank decide to get together, and I'm running out of time, so I'll say the story very, very quickly, and I can talk more about it during the Q&A. They get together a delegation, and they fly to Israel, and they meet the Israeli government, and they say, this is embarrassing, we spent so much money fighting these lawsuits, we've lost the lawsuits, you have to release the money. And the Israeli government says, no, we're not going to release the money, wartime, all the stuff that the Israeli government has been saying. And the banks say, okay, fine, don't release the money, we're pulling out of Israel. And then the Israeli government says, okay, wait. The Israeli government says, okay, we'll be willing to unfreeze the money, but the problem is that we spent all the money. You know, and this is Israel in 1956, you know, is in a very, very difficult situation itself. It's absolutely overrun by refugees itself, you know, people fleeing the Holocaust. It's applied for loans to Britain and hasn't got any money. It's absolutely cash out. It's not the Israel of today. It is this country that's struggling for its own survival. And it says, this £6 million, we spent it, you know, 5 years ago. So if you give us a loan for that amount, interest-free, payable over a long period of time, we'll be willing to release the account. The banks agree. And that's in the end what happens. Ottoman Bank and Barclays Bank form a loan syndicate and issue a loan for £12 million to the Israeli government. Interest-free. Actually, it wasn't interest-free. It was very, very low interest, payable over a 20-year period. And the Israeli government, in return, releases, in principle, those £6 million. And in principle, Barclays and Ottoman Bank then proceed to pay out all their customers. I want to end the story here because, I want to end on a happy note. And it's this really, really rare case in Palestinian history, which almost never happens, which is that everybody is happy. The Israelis, who are cash-strapped and really desperate and struggling at this point in time, get a loan. They've applied for loans all over the place. They've been refused by everyone, but they get a loan, and a significant, a £12 million loan from Barclays and Ottoman Bank. The banks managed to get rid of this headache of these lawsuits and this bad publicity that all of this had been generating, and they get to walk away with the story of, you know, look, we're British banks and we're so reliable because, after all, we released the money. British government gets to say, look, you know, this is what the British, you know, ideas of fairness and fair play, see, we released the money in the end. And the Arab Palestinians, who lost every single battle since 1936 and so much more since 1948, won this once, and they got their money back.
Thank you. You have been listening to Palestinian scholar Srimati Mitter giving the fascinating history of the freezing of Arab-Palestinian bank accounts following Israel's declaration of independence. There is no end to the brutality of the takeover by Israel in 1948, nor the treachery of the British Mandate. And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You'll find us here at 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You can also stream us live on your computer at wzbc.org. To hear the program later in the day or to listen at any other time of the week via the archive found in the WZBC homepage, simply click on Archive and go to Sunday morning, 8 a.m., and click on Listen. However, each program is temporarily on this archive for only 2 weeks. After 2 weeks to reach our permanent archive to hear any and all of our past broadcasts, go to truthandjusticeradio.org and click on This Week in Palestine Archives. It is all there due to the diligence of our colleague Stan Robinson. Thanks for listening, and we hope you will join us again next Sunday and every Sunday for another edition of This Week in Palestine. You are tuned to WZBC 90.3 FM, Newton, Massachusetts. And this is John Roberts wishing you a good morning.
She's the same wherever you go. She is the Mother of God. She's the universal life force. Satan is very good at accommodating whatever culture, whatever age, whatever clime you happen to be in. Make a difference to him. He's very good at accommodating it. What I simply mean by that is he'll make you feel comfortable wherever you live in accepting his religion.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with old Lake Oxford economist Martin Summers, author Gilad Atzmon, and me, Tony Gosling. US Secretary of State Mike Pompeo visits NATO in Brussels, where he explains US tactics of economic warfare. Why China, Iran and Russia are in the IMF and the Pentagon's sights now. The latest enemy. And with all this talk of the Irish border, how neutral really is the Irish Republic. Edward Horgan's a former major in the Irish Army who's been exposing the use of Shannon Airport for rendition flights. Rendition may be over, but Edward believes Obama's drone assassination policy now being carried out almost daily is far worse. And there are troop flights landing at Shannon almost every day. Ireland, the second unsinkable aircraft carrier. How can they be neutral? Plus the announcement of further charges against Israeli President Benjamin Netanyahu, alleged to have bribed a news site to get favourable coverage for him and his wife. Also, Britain's state-sponsored child sexual abuse scandal rumbles on, with many of the VIP defiles potentially in the clear. While, in a shocking turn of events, those who take allegations to the police could find themselves in jail. We hear from a former Metropolitan Police detective who's getting increasingly concerned that survivors of child sex abuse are being character assassinated through changes in the criminal justice system. Our sister show Dialect is here at BCFM at noon on Tuesday. This week we speak to Scott Ritter. We had a clip from the interview last week, a thorough look at his work as an Iraq weapons inspector and his view of the Middle East today. Also, a deep look at what's going on in the geopolitics of the world with the Russian-born filmmaker, philosopher, poet, author and writer Andrei Vilcek, who lives in Beirut. Listen here at BCFM 93.2 at noon next Tuesday, or download it now from dialectradio.co.uk. And we start, though, Martin, with this visit by Steve Bannon to Brussels. This week, it absolutely seems as if these three countries, China, Russia and Iran, are most definitely in the sights of the Americans these days.
Well, a Russian senior Russian figure said the other week, we are preparing for a war. I think he's a diplomat. The other side are preparing for... we're preparing for war in general. They are preparing for a war. So it'd be very...
Which war is that?
Well, it would be very remiss of the political leadership in China, Russia or Iran not to be preparing for war with the West, since the West insists on banging the drum for having a war.
But it's not just the West, it's mainly the United States, surely.
It's the United States. It's the axis of evil, isn't it? It's the United States, Britain and Israel.
And surely the Americans are quite happy that the EU and Europe seems to be falling apart with all sorts of secession movements, etc. This benefits the Americans, doesn't it?
It does. And of course, you know, the current administration in the US is quite clear they want the breakup of the EU because they see it as a potential rival and also, of course, a potential stepping stone to a rapprochement with Russia. So they're trying to get rid of the Nord Stream 2 pipeline, which the Germans are keen on having, which will give, you know, natural gas from Russia much cheaper to German industry. And they want to do everything they can to smash that because they want the Germans to buy their more expensive liquefied natural gas.
Now, Gilad, you were talking earlier about the bankers. Now, this is the IMF and the World Bank. And Steve Bannon this week is talking the US Secretary of State about using these banks as a weapon of war.
Now, before we get into Steve Bannon, because tomorrow actually I'm taking part in a conference about World War III and different aspects and possibilities. What this war is going to be, and my position is that A, World War III is already here. Mm-hmm. B, World War III is not a war across countries, but it is a war that split countries. It's a war that split countries. It's a war that split societies. The debate that you two had before, just 10 minutes ago, is a prime example. We saw it in the recent two elections in the United States, in the midterm and in the presidential. We see it in Paris tomorrow. We will see it in Paris tomorrow. The war is a war between nationalists, people who define themselves as bonded to soil and see themselves as one people, and identitarians who are cosmopolitan.
Hang on. That's not happening in Paris. I mean, no. What's happening in Paris is actually the old socialists are saying, we've had enough of this. Actually, what they're really protesting about is austerity, the fact that they don't have enough work, they don't have enough money to feed their kids, to pay the rent, and all this sort of thing. Now, it's been very interesting to see, because Macron said, didn't he, that there was no way he was going to turn back this policy of increasing fuel taxes. And, of course, it's mostly diesel tax and car to drive around, that sort of tax. But these are energy taxes which go right across the society. But, now, he said, I'm not going to go back on that, he said. Yeah. But actually, he went back on it. And now he's issued this challenge to the French people for tomorrow, saying, if you go out on the streets tomorrow, there's no excuse anymore. You're going to be
in jail. Yeah. Now, I think that actually Paris is France is exactly this the same thing. There are people who are concerned with nationalist issues. All those taxes, new taxes that are put on the French people.
I mean, this seems to be a confrontation. It seems to be very confrontational of a president to do this.
One minute. You know, it is not an identitarian battle. It's a battle that, a nationalist battle that is unique to France. Now.
Look, hang on, because really what's going on is surely it's, you're right in some ways, but it's a battle about who's in charge. Is it the people or is it the president?
Fine. But this is a legitimate, battle. This is the battle of politics. What I believe is, now I go back to your previous question, is that all those wars that we see between, that it's actually, as you said, it's Britain, the axis of evil, Britain, America, and Israel. I used to call them at the time BBS, Bush, Blair, Sharon. Now we have to change the initials. Are wars that are there to deviate or to divert the attention from the civil wars that we see in every Western society. This is a very crucial issue, and this is why the debate about the Brexit, for instance, is so confusing. Every piece of news is there to confuse us rather than to.
Well, look, let's go to Mike Pompeo now, because I was fascinated to hear that the first time I've ever heard a U.S. Secretary of State talking openly about the way that we will use economic warfare against these countries. Pompeo is Secretary of State. Let's have a listen to him now in Brussels a couple of days ago.
The World Bank and the IMF. The Trump administration is working to refocus these institutions on policies that promote economic prosperity, pushing to halt lending to nations that can already access global capital markets, countries like China, and pressing to reduce taxpayer handouts to development banks that are perfectly capable of raising private capital on their own. We're also taking leadership, real action, to stop rogue international courts like the International Criminal Court from trampling on our sovereignty, your sovereignty, and all of our freedoms. The ICC's Office of the Prosecutor is trying to open an investigation into U.S. personnel in connection with the war in Afghanistan. We will take all necessary steps to protect our people, those of our NATO allies who fight alongside of us inside of Afghanistan, from unjust prosecution. Because we know if it can happen to our people, it can happen to yours too. It is a worthy question. Does the court continue to serve its original intended purpose? The first 2 years of the Trump administration demonstrate that President Trump is not undermining these institutions, nor is he abandoning American leadership. Quite the opposite. In the finest traditions of our great democracy, we are rallying the noble nations of the world to build a new liberal order that prevents war and achieves greater prosperity for all. We're supporting institutions that we believe can be improved, institutions that work in American interests and yours, in service of our shared values. For example, here in Belgium, in 1973, banks from 15 countries formed SWIFT, developed common standards for cross-border payments, and it's now an integral part of our global financial infrastructure. SWIFT recently disconnected sanctioned Iranian banks from its platform because of the unacceptable risk they pose to the system as a whole. This is an excellent example of American leadership working alongside an international institution to act responsibly.
Well, I mean, the SWIFT system was set up by the Americans to make sure that they could basically pull the plug on it at any point, which is what they're doing. They blackball the Iranians. And the International Criminal Court, of course, the United States isn't part of the International Criminal Court. They never signed up for it. Of course, Slobodan Milosevic and various minor dictators from Africa have been, some of them wrongly accused by the International Criminal Court. It's seen in the Third World as basically a puppet court of the Americans, and the Americans aren't even in it.
The evidence is Milosevic was actually poisoned by the court, killed by the court.
Well, killed by people around it, yeah. So in other words, this
in custody.
What's clear with what Pompeo is pushing there, don't forget that the rest of the world doesn't agree with putting sanctions back on Iran. This is just America and Israel. Nobody else agrees with this.
What about this extraordinary piece of news this week about the Huawei, the daughter of the founder of Huawei being arrested in Canada? Idea being that they want to.
Well, they're going after the Chinese ruling class as they go about their business, and it caused a lot of anger in China, obviously, and of course it caused the stock market to start going down.
Well,
trade war that he started. Do you know what's happened? The trade deficit has increased since he started the trade war, because trade wars don't in fact solve your trade problem, especially if you're running a massive budget deficit as they are. If you're going to run a budget deficit like that, you've got to have a trade deficit. It's part of the logic of what you're doing. So he's not going to get rid of the trade deficit by having a trade war. What he's doing is shaking the stock market like this, and suddenly it's going to break, isn't it?
Get back to this Huawei thing, because I think it's fascinating to see what that is about, because the Americans have been trying to persuade Huawei to give them some sort of security access to their various electronics devices. Obviously, they're a major mobile and telecommunications company, the biggest in China. And now the Chinese say, no, well, we're not going to give you, security access to this. This is our intellectual property. And so they've kidnapped, effectively, arrested anyway, the daughter of the guy that founded the company in Canada.
Well, they've also, the fact is they're claiming that she's broken sanctions on Iran. She's broken sanctions on Iran, which, of course, only the Americans are imposing. So they impose sanctions on Iran, and the Chinese entrepreneur is blamed for breaking sanctions on Iran, but we haven't got sanctions. So, it's only you that's got sanctions on Iran.
So the Americans can arrest anybody that breaks sanctions that they impose. This is starting to get like gangster tactics, Gilad.
Yes, we'll talk about it, and this is... the new world. This is the new world in which we are living. We see really low evaporating all the Western ethos. And for me, this is exactly the battle between Athens and Jerusalem. Leo Strauss introduced this idea to the West. He's not the guy whom I admired. He said that in the West, the Western culture ethos is a battle between two schools of thought, between Athens, between the idea that is regarded, the city that is regarded as the birthplace of philosophy, of reason, where we think through, and Jerusalem, which is the city of revelation, where we follow law, order, commandment, mitzvot, as they call it. What we see is in the West, we are drifting away from thinking, from reason, from science, from ethics, and we have more and more rules that are actually, sadly enough, gangsters' rules.
Okay, let me give another example. Last weekend, Russia Today, a Russia TV spies, we're told by the Daily Mail, are caught at top-secret UK army base. How the fake news team tried to infiltrate the British psychological warfare unit. Now, this sounds very Orwellian. It's like the fake news team of the Russians, Brigade 77
well,
inside.
What's happened there is an RT film crew went to the headquarters of Brigade 77, which we were told has been set up a couple of years ago. This is the British Army's psychological warfare unit. It's got 1,000 members in it, all of whom are officers. So they're all officers. So they must be paying a fortune for this. And I just read an article not long ago. They've virtually decamped 100% to Ukraine. They've virtually moved their whole headquarters to Ukraine, which suggests that they are planning something in Ukraine. But anyway, the TV crew just went to film outside it and say, this is it, this is where they do the stuff.
Well, the Daily Mail puts it in rather chilling terms. Steel yourself for this. Security cameras at the unit's base recorded Russian TV reporter Timur Siravtsev making passes of the highly sensitive facility as a cameraman filmed from a car.
Oh, no. It's a TV cameraman? A TV? They're a TV station and they've got a cameraman? It's just appalling. What are they doing?
That RT are basically just doing what our media don't really seem to want to do, which is to ask questions about what is this unit?
Why can't they go and stand outside the place and say, well, this is it, these are the people going in and out? It's a perfectly legitimate thing for them to do, isn't it?
What do you make of this kind of news story, Gillette? Because it actually made me laugh to read this. Who is the fake news guy?
I'm an immigrant, so kind of I have kind of a transcendental a vision of the life in this country and the way it has been. It has been transforming kind of over kind of the last 20 years, and I think that whether you realize it or not, this country at the moment is unfortunately tyrannical. It reminds me all those stories of Russian immigrants told us when they came to Israel in the 70s. Simply, you know, you look at the news and you don't understand what is the story, what they try to hide.
Okay, so is it just the Americans running the show here, telling us what to do?
No,
or is
I think that the Brits are quite good in being tyrannical, as Orwell actually predicted.
They're gangsters too.
Yeah.
Okay, let's have a listen to Mike Pompeo, not Steve Bannon, over in Brussels, where he really lays out US foreign policy, which is I'm used to Secretaries of State doing, not talking about the latest bits of the toolkit of the Economic Warfare Brigade. But anyway, so this is what he has to say about China, Iran, and Russia.
Bad actors have exploited our lack of leadership for their own gain. This is the poisoned fruit of American retreat. President Trump is determined to reverse that. China's economic development did not lead to an embrace of democracy and regional stability. It led to more political repression and regional provocations. We welcomed China into the liberal order, but never policed its behavior. China has routinely exploited loopholes in the World Trade Organization rules, imposed market restrictions, forced technology transfers, and stolen intellectual property. And it knows that world opinion is powerless to stop its Orwellian human rights violations. Iran didn't join the Community of Nations after the nuclear deal was inked. It spread its newfound riches to terrorists and to dictators. Tehran holds multiple American hostages, and Bob Levinson has been missing there for 11 years. Iran has blatantly disregarded UN Security Council resolutions, lied to the International Atomic Energy Agency inspectors about its nuclear program, and evaded UN sanctions. Just this past week, Iran test-fired a ballistic missile in violation of UN Security Council Resolution 2231. Earlier this year, Tehran used the U.S.-Iran Treaty of Amity to bring baseless claims against the United States before the International Court of Justice. Most all of this malign activity during the JCPOA. Russia. Russia hasn't embraced Western values of freedom and international cooperation. Rather, it has suppressed opposition voices and invaded the sovereign nations of Georgia and of Ukraine. Moscow has also deployed a military-grade nerve agent on foreign soil, right here in Europe, in violation of the Chemical Weapons Convention, to which it is a party. And as I'll detail later today, Russia has violated the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty for many years.
I mean, in a way, the Trump administration pulling out of the Intermediate Nuclear Weapons Treaty is one of the most serious things. But he's making a lot of accusations against these countries, really trying to build a case for these people, these countries being made total pariahs around the world.
Well, I mean, it's basically wall-to-wall war propaganda, isn't it? It's just war propaganda of the most cynical and, frankly, clumsy kind. I mean, there's no real case made there at all, is there?
Yeah, but I mean, he's references in, like a Security Council Revolution 2231, apparently says that Iran are not allowed to fire any missiles.
Iran is entitled to have missiles. Why aren't they entitled to have missiles?
Of course.
It's absurd to suggest otherwise.
This is what is amazing to see when you listen to Pompeo. You can understand why America is so frustrated with China. It's still a communist country, and it is a leading economy. It is leading technologically. It's actually way ahead of every Western country. Iran definitely must exercise its ballistic capability because it is under constant threat by America, Israel, and Britain. And Russia, there is no doubt that Putin, whether you like him or not, you'd agree with him or not, has managed to expel the Americans from the Middle East. Putin has won every battle he was pushed into. He's definitely a sophisticated leader. We don't have anything like that in the West. So it is very clear why a person like Pompeo or Trump are frustrated.
Would you say rattled? They're rattled by Putin. They're not getting their way anymore.
No, absolutely not. Absolutely not. And they don't stand a chance because American elite, and unfortunately, as we can see in the last few weeks, or we know it for more than a while, our British elite are a bunch of intellectually, spiritually, and politically castrated characters who cannot lead countries and definitely not qualified to lead countries. And I think that what we will see in the West, we will see a new populist bunch of politicians that will come with a new voice.
You seem to be talking about this whole thing of imposter syndrome. I mean, it's been talked about quite a lot, this idea that you've got people in leadership positions who almost look as if they're looking from side to side, wondering what they're doing there.
It is very true. And actually, I cover this issue in my book about the post-political narrative. When we grew up 20, 30, 40, 50 years ago, the politicians, as we understood it then, were there to fulfill our whims, that we had kind of a connection with the system. At a certain stage, we were reduced into consumers, and the role of the politician was very simple, to sustain consumption by means of credit. You are an economist, so you can say, we can decide whether I'm telling the truth or not. Now, this is not the situation. They are committed to Goldman Sachs. They are committed to global bankers. They are not committed to us as people. And this is a tragedy. And unfortunately, the labor is no different. But Corbyn is so popular because he is different. Because he is an old-fashioned leader. Bernie Sanders in America was popular because he is a kind of an old lefty, whether you agree with it or not. And for the same reason, Trump was so popular. What is so interesting to see is actually Bernie Sanders, Corbyn, and Trump have a lot in common, despite the fact that they don't agree politically on anything.
Okay, now, one of the problems of all of this is that we're finding increasing restrictions on what intellectuals and particularly university professors are allowed to say. We had an example of that we discussed last week on here. Keith van der Peel, who was the former head of international relations at Sussex University, was criticised for suggesting that the Israeli government, the Mossad, for example, was involved in some way in the 9/11 attacks.
Yes.
And so I thought we'd have a little listen to him now. He was speaking on the Richie Allen show earlier last week, I think it was, when he spoke about the way that journalists are actually being censored nowadays. And he doesn't feel that the whole system of the media is really doing its job properly.
both journalists and academics already in advance impose a measure of self-censorship which goes well beyond what the system, by its current rules, would still allow, you know? So there's probably even less critical material around these days, you know, never mind the courageous people who continue to write good stuff, but there's probably even less critical stuff around than would be possible if people were really testing the limits of what is still allowed. But nobody is encouraged to do that because it might cost you a whole year of work and only to find yourself rejected. So in that sense, we are in a very sorry situation. There are many negative developments both in journalism and in academia, which each have their own rules, of course. And these, the self-discipline is the most frightening at the moment, I find. You know, the way that people, that journalists, for instance, are forgetting about their colleague Julian Assange, who's holed up in this Ecuadorian embassy under terrible conditions. Nobody ever asks any longer what happened to Edward Snowden and so on and so forth. So the journalists are giving up their critical task because they want to survive in the current media environment, and the academics do the same. They are all becoming embedded academics. Again, let me always make the exception for the good people who are still somehow entrenching in small groups that continue to work, to do important work. But most of them are part of the ideological machine. Eisenhower already, President Eisenhower, in his famous farewell address of 1961, when he spoke of the military-industrial complex, he actually his speechwriters actually had proposed the title military-industrial academic complex, but in the end they dropped academic, not because the academics are not in large numbers recruited for this military-industrial enterprise, but because it wasn't snazzy enough to have such a long label.
And he also talked about specific problems for academics who criticize Israel.
Criticism of Israel is easily equated to denial that 6 million Jews, and in my mind actually more, were murdered in the Second World War by the Nazis and their accomplices. So you have to disentangle these things. People often forget that, for instance, on the eve of the invasion of Iraq by Blair and Bush, two-thirds of American Jews were against that adventure, in line with the general population, of course.
Yeah.
So you can see that any form of generalization is very dangerous. You should focus very clearly on the real forces that are at work, identify of whom you have the actual documentation, and then try to piece together how, in a very broad context, these forces have operated.
I actually looked into these topics extensively. We went through a big, very big change in the last 20 years, as we have been exploring in the last 2 hours. And yet, academia was totally silent about it. The fact that we were reduced into consumers, that the political world changed, media was silent about it. And when you start to look into the mechanism that sustained this silence, you find out, obviously, that it has a lot to do with political correctness. What is political correctness? No one tries to understand what it is. Political correctness is basically politics that doesn't allow political opposition. Politics that doesn't allow political opposition is the definition of tyranny. This, when Pompeo is talking about China or Russia or Iran, political correctness is the thing that sustained American politics, British politics. Now,
because if you're thinking about this in parliamentary political terms, it's almost as if the opposition doesn't actually go for the weakest points of the government. It's more like a kind of controlled opposition.
Of course, control opposition is the next fragment that we must discuss. Just to finish this point about political correctness. Political correctness, in fact, is way more dangerous than tyranny. And the reason is, in tyranny, you are suppressed by an external element. So you know that you don't like Stalin or Hitler. But in a case of political correctness, it is a self-suppression. And there is, you are silent, but the next step, you just forget how to think appropriately. You learn to cheat to yourself.
Well, and this about, is exactly. How about apathy?
But this is exactly where we are now. This is exactly where we are. And because we are so apathetic, we can consume this BBC nonsense coverage.
Okay, the Saudis, he talks about Kees van der Peel as well, and the Israelis, he believes, were involved in the September the 11th attacks. Now, is that a legitimate point of view or a thought crime?
But to start with, every point of view is legitimate. The only criterion that we should uphold is whether you can substantiate what you are saying.
Well, let's see what Kees van der Peel's got to say.
Who commented that what should be investigated is not me, but the statement that I made, and that was a comment. Somebody accused Saudi Arabia of a number of things. Of course, as the bottom line, it's genocidal war in Yemen. And the whole list started with Saudis blew up the Twin Towers. And because I had just been reading some materials which made very clear that these were actually Israeli bomb experts who had been posing as artists working in the Twin Towers, who had prepared the demolition charges for the bringing down the towers. I replied, not Saudis, but Israelis with help from U.S. Zionists in the U.S. government blew up these towers. It was just a short correction. But that led to an explosion of pro-Israel groups who, to my amazement, didn't make any distinction between, let's say, Jewish people in general, Israeli people as a special category, and the current Israeli government, which is, in my view, the most far-right government the country has had, and who have a documented history of preparing all kind of terrorist activities, including a grand scheme on which they have worked for decades to let the U.S., as the head of a Western coalition, take over Israel's role as the war party in the Middle East. And but I didn't spell out all these details. I just said the Twin Towers, which is one aspect of the whole 9/11 saga, were blown up by Israeli operatives, and that's a documented fact. It will take some time before that's generally accepted.
Well, as you know, Tony, we've been looking into this ever since it happened, from virtually the moment it happened. I and you and others have been looking into it, and we've got a mountain of evidence now that suggests that that what people are being told about what happened there is simply wrong. And the latest copper's hunch we all have on it, I think Mossad were very definitely involved, but also so were CIA, MI6. They didn't operate on their own. So these people are terrorist manipulators, and the Saudi connection is very important because, of course, it's everybody knows that Al-Qaeda was set up by Western intelligence services. Everybody's seen the Tom Cruise film where Charlie Wilson's war, and they go to Israel to pick up loads of Soviet bloc weapons, which are going to be transferred to the Mujahideen, Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan, and everybody is all involved at that stage. And the story is that Al-Qaeda, which was set up by Western intelligence with the cooperation of Mossad, the Safari Club, suddenly went rogue and started attacking its founders. Rubbish. Al-Qaeda is a front organization for Western intelligence services, as the Russian general staff increasingly understand.
So are you a thought criminal, Gilad? Or do you think that Keith should be sacked from his job? Or apparently he's only an emeritus professor.
Of course not. I think that the reason that I came to live in this country is because I believe this country to be free, and it was free when I landed here 25 years ago. It is definitely not a free country. It is very depressing to see what is happening here, and far from being surprising, the elements that are the most suppressive here are actually Zionist. Interestingly enough, you are way more free to talk about all those issues in Tel Aviv than in London. Your audience will be surprised to hear that Haaretz and Ynet and other Wallah, other Israeli papers are way more critical of Israel than the Guardian of Judea.
Now, Mandela's grandson has been visiting Israel this week, and he has said, that's Nelson Mandela's grandson, he says that Israel is the worst apartheid regime in the world. That's in, I think it's maybe even this morning's Jerusalem Post.
Yeah, in fact, I think that I'm saying it for years, and I get into a lot of trouble for saying it. I don't think that Israel...
So anyway, that illustrates your point, doesn't it?
Yeah, they're saying it
in the Jerusalem Post.
For sure,
but
for sure.
But you won't see that in the Times, for example.
For sure, for sure. And in fact, I think that for saying it, you are in a breach of the IHRA definition. Yeah, you can get penalized. But by the way, I don't think that that Israel is apartheid. I think that it's far worse, because apartheid is a racist system of exploitation. Israel is an ethnic cleanser. It wants the Palestinians gone. And in as such, it actually reminds us a very vile regime that was operating in Europe
also,
in the 30s.
Also this week, police are recommending bribery charges against Netanyahu in the telecom media case. Cops have urged indictments in the Bezek corruption probe for the Prime Minister and his wife. The owner and his wife, Netanyahu, downplays the bombshell. He says the timing is transparent. It was on the police chief's last day. So just before the chief of police leaves, he makes sure that he makes it absolutely clear he believes that the Prime Minister's criminal.
Yeah, I think that it is quite amazing to see it. Netanyahu is obviously not the first one. Ehud Olmert, who was prime minister, spent some time in jail. President Katsav was in jail. He was a sex criminal. So this won't be new. It is quite interesting that the Israelis are actually indicting and charging their leaders. This is very interesting. However, I think that the case of Netanyahu is very interesting, because the more accusations are tossed in his directions, in his direction, and most indictments, the more popular he becomes.
Okay, let me just read out. It says, in a blistering accusation, police said the Prime Minister and his associates intervened in a blatant and ongoing manner, sometimes even daily, in the content published by the Wallah News website, and also sought to influence the appointment of senior officials, editors and reporters via their contacts with Shaul and Iris Elovich. That is, he's the owner's wife. The main suspicion is that the Prime Minister took bribes and acted in a conflict of interest by intervening and acting in regulatory decisions that favoured the Eloviches and the Bezek Group, while at the same time directly and indirectly demanding interference with the content. I mean, this just sounds to me like the sort of gangster tactics. Actually, we used to get this from people like Peter Mandelson.
I think
journalists getting threatened in this country, saying, you write anything like that again, you'll be out of your job.
Of course. And, you know, I think that Netanyahu may have something in common with Peter Mandelson. But I think that in order to understand what is happening there and why he is getting away with it is because Israel is not operating as a sovereign modern state. It is operating as a shtetl. What is a shtetl? It's operating as a Jewish ghetto, close community. It's now surrounded with walls. And Netanyahu doesn't operate as a prime minister. He sees himself as a king.
UN chief suggests deploying armed forces to protect the Palestinians from Israel. That's in the Middle East Monitor this week. The combination of prolonged military occupation, constant security threats, weak political institutions, and a deadlocked peace process provides for a protection challenge that is a highly complex politically, legally, and practically. Do you think that's feasible? Middle East Monitor say it may be.
I think that it is a necessity. I think that it is a necessity because we are dealing with a criminal state that has probably the longest record of human rights abuse. Whether this can happen with people like Pompeo and Teresa Jesuit-Juif May in the Elm, it's not a clear question.
Will Netanyahu be phoning up the United Nations and saying, right, I want this guy sacked for bringing out this report?
By the way, I don't know if you saw it yesterday, there was a vote in the United Nations. Israel called for denouncing the Hamas, and the vote, it needed kind of two-thirds, I think, in support, and they didn't manage to achieve it. But quite a lot of countries supported Israel. So I think that what... When we talk about Israel, we should never try to differentiate it with its satellite Jewish lobbies that are very, very domineering within the Western arena. And I'm talking about every Western state, Canada, America, France, Britain, of course, Germany, Italy even, and so on and so on.
Okay, so we've heard interesting bit of news this week. Albert Einstein's God Letter sells for $2.9 million in the BBC News. This is a handwritten letter by Albert Einstein, which he grapples with the concept of religion. But there's actually another. And this is my conspiracy theory mind here, going 19 to the dozen, because actually there's a much more interesting letter by Albert Einstein, and that is one where he actually accuses the nascent Israeli state of behaving like Nazis. What he says is that the conservative Zionist elements in the United States, several Americans of national repute, have lent their names to welcome his visit. Talking about the Israeli leader visiting America, it's inconceivable that those who oppose fascism throughout the world, if correctly informed, as in Mr. Begin's political, and that's where the end of the quote goes. But he's basically accusing the early Israelis of being fascists, Einstein. And yeah, if you search for the Einstein letter now, all you get is this most recent one.
Yeah, so it's very interesting. I would never, all right, I'm not a conspiracy guy. I would never think of that innovative, but it is very, very interesting. Yeah, but I think...
What do you make of that Einstein letter?
The one that you just read. Yeah, I think that it is far from being surprising. He was telling the truth as he saw it, and they had
I ought to actually quote, really. He says that lest America be fooled by post-independence rhetoric, the Herut party Begin led was, in quotes, closely akin to the Nazi and fascist parties.
Yeah, I think that he would definitely be kicked out from the Labour Party for saying it. because, as we discussed before, this is exactly what happened to Ken Livingstone. I think that the ideological association between Jewish paramilitaries bodies in Palestine in the 30s, in the 40s, and then early Israeli politics, the association with fascist ideology was clear to everyone. Zev Jabotinsky, who was their political mentor, was a clear admirer of Mussolini and some of his followers.
Look, I know you're not a religious Jew at all, right? But I'd love to get your take.
I'm not religious.
Well, so definitely neither of those. But I'd love to get your take on the Third Temple, because that's come up again in the last few weeks. The idea to recreate this Third Temple in Jerusalem is absolutely key, apparently, in some of the far right-wing religious Jews, including Netanyahu, wants to make this happen. There's only one problem, of course. wars, the Al-Aqsa Mosque is in the way.
It's in the way. It's a big problem. It is very clear to me and that the only people within this Zionist arena, Israeli arena, Israeli politics, who actually talk sense are those hardcore Zionist Third Temple enthusiasts. And it's not because I agree with them, obviously I'm not, but they are consistent and coherent. They know exactly what they want. They believe that they know how to achieve it, and big war is big global war is definitely the right path for it, and they are pushing for it.
And this could spark something between the Iranians and the
absolutely,
Israelis,
absolutely. And so I thought about it today. Israel, it's just something kind of. I had an insight on the way here. Israel is obsessed with nuclear weapons. But Israel doesn't need nuclear weapons because its battle is a local battle with Palestinians. The only reason that sustains the need of nuclear weapons is a war with a country like Iran that is kind of 2,000 miles away. So actually Israel needs its nuclear its battle with Iran, and it's invented this battle in order to sustain the relevance of its nuclear industry. We have to think like Israelis to understand it.
Marvelous moment of clarity.
Yeah.
More of those. More power to your elbow. Also, the big piece of news this week, the death of George H.W. Bush. And the Consortium News has actually put a pretty critical article about him, saying it was a case of Bush, CIA, and a case of state-sponsored terrorism. 42 years ago, a car bomb exploded in Washington, killing Chile's ex-foreign minister Orlando Letelier. In an act of terrorism, the CIA and its director George Bush tried to cover up. This is what Robert Parry, who died early this year, I think, covered in 2000. Martin, what do you make of this, not this particular story, but about George H.W. Bush's record? I know Webster Tarpley, actually, along with Anton Chaitkin, wrote a rather brilliant, and I would recommend it to anybody who really wants to get to know George H.W. Bush. It was called The Unauthorized Biography.
Well, he's been a long-term bad guy, and the Bush family are long-term bad guy people. And of course, the suspicion
Mike
is.
Mike Pompeo was talking about the bad guys. He was saying the bad guys. China.
Everybody says, we're the good guys, they're the bad guys. We all play this game, don't we? But I mean, the fact is, it's quite sickening to see the elite in the US. You know, Clinton's there. They're all there going, oh, what a great guy H.W. Bush was. He was a criminal. He carried out military coups. He assassinated people. He probably was involved in the assassination of Kennedy. He was certainly in Dallas on the day, and it looks like he was the operational commander of the hit. But we're all supposed to go, well, he was a great guy. Even Clinton, you know, he was a Republican, but he was a great American. And just think, maybe Saddam Hussein was right. Weapons of mass destruction. It's the only way to deal with these people. That's a joke, by the way.
You know something about Bush.
Sorry, Gilad, I just want to get into the next piece. If you want to say something quickly about Bush, go for it.
No. I think that he's the last American president who really grew through the military, served in the army, was actually, I don't know if he was a hero, but he was definitely kind of rescued. And this is when you look at the first Gulf War, he managed to build a coalition. I'm obviously in total opposition to everything he did, but America really lost this capacity completely.
Okay, so our next story is to do with child sex abuse, VI paedophiles potentially in the clear. In a shocking turn of events, those who take allegations to the police could find themselves in jail. We hear tonight from John Wedger, former Metropolitan Police detective, who's getting concerned that survivors of child sex abuse are being character assassinated by changes to the criminal justice system.
If you take what we call the vetting system, so in the police service, if you start going to the very secure sort of jobs, and I did have one of them, you get vetted. So they will then go through all your personal circumstances, and they need to know everything about you. They need to know all your sexual partners. They need to know your medical history, even your financial history. So anything that's dirty can be used against you, i.e. blackmailed, because you're going to end up in compromised situations. And one of the things that was said to me was that, and this was said by a female sergeant, that quite a few officers that are homosexual, it's not political correctness or anything like that, and there's no way this is a homophobic rant, this is just what was said to me, fail the vetting because they could possibly be compromised due to their sexual history and the amount of sexual partners they've had. So if we look at that, then we take people like Ted Heath, and I've taken accounts of a couple of people now that remember Ted Heath from the day when he was just a parliamentarian, and he would cruise like the sort of gay hangouts for young men. So he would go, one of his favourite places was Jack Straw's Castle, the car park in Hampstead Heath, where he would go and pick up young boys that had come from the care homes. Now, he would have had, back then, Special Branch would have been made aware, you know, of what was going on, especially when he was moving up the political ladder, the hierarchy it is. Then you would have started implementing protection officers. They would know what was going on. So this information would have been fed back into the system that this man is a bit of a loose cannon, and he, you know, what's going on with him. Yet he was allowed to hold the highest position of office, that being a prime minister, with such a monumental, checkered and perverted past, because he was procuring young boys for sex. Yet he was allowed to become a prime minister, and anyone who spoke out against it, we see what they do. They go out their way to absolutely destroy them. And what also we've seen, and I'm drawing a parallel with the way that I believe they knew a lot of this was going to come out well in advance, was the implementation of the 2003 Criminal Justice Act, which a section of it goes on about a person's bad character. Now, when someone years ago was in a Crown Court, they couldn't make any reference to their previous criminal history unless there were certain exemptions that applied, and they were very rare, and they needed a lot of preparation. It was called similar fact evidence, and it's now been superseded by this Bad Character Act. So the Bad Character Act didn't just involve someone's bad character criminally. They could use information from a care home, from a school, from an employer. So a lot of, like we mentioned, people that have been subject to horrendous abuse and sexual abuse in childhood, there is a propensity for them to then self-medicate either via alcohol or via drugs. And the drug of choice, pretty much still now, it was heroin. And, you know, in order to sustain a heroin addiction, usually you've got to take on criminal activity such as shoplifting or prostitution or whatever. So you end up, on the whole, getting caught, getting arrested for minor petty theft. But that is classed as dishonesty. So when you go before a court as a witness, you are straight away tarred with the label of being a man or a woman of dishonest character. So we're seeing this a lot with these victims that are coming forward with allegations. They're being demonised straight away. And they might be drug addicts, they might be thieves, but they might have lied in the past. But under our fairness system, we've got to give everyone a chance. And, you know, anyone that makes allegations of that severe nature, you know, you've got to stand by them allegations. And there's so many sort of threshold tests, you know, and all the years of interviewing children and the many, many cases I've had, there was only one case where a kid was actually proved to be a liar. On the whole, people don't make these allegations up. There is no financial inducement for them that will ever be like a reparation for what they've been through.
That's a former Metropolitan Police Detective Constable DC John Wedger there. And we have some more from him next week as well, which goes into a bit more detail about his analysis of the whole Jimmy Savile case. Time to sign off now for the Murdoch News at 8 o'clock. Coming up live on Facebook, it's Arabian Nights with Mohammed Bakawi. Thanks to our guests in the first hour. That was actually... I'm not quite sure it wasn't the first hour. But anyway, it was Israeli-born saxophonist right the way through the show and author Gilad Atzmon. Thanks to old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers too. Our sister show Dialects on Tuesday at noon. You'll find this week's show's podcast, story links, comment page and our contact details at thisweekoneword.org.uk. I'm on Twitter at Tony Gosling. Here's wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable BCFM weekend. Do please join us on the Politics Show at 6 o'clock next week. God bless. And don't let the banksters get you down.
This is Pacifica Radio's Letters on Politics. On today's show...
And Napishtim gets everybody to... says, I am bad for you. The gods don't like me anymore. Build me an ark so I can get out of here. So he lies, fools everybody. They build this great ark, and then the rains come, and everybody drowns. And this is a horrible storm.
But there are people that say this is where we get the story in the Bible of the flood.
Oh, for sure.
No doubt.
No doubt. I mean, letting go the dove that comes back, and then the raven finally that doesn't, that finds dry land somewhere. When it was first published in 1872, that was the tablet that Smith published, and it caused riots. People threw bricks through the windows of the newspaper that published it because it implied that the Bible is plagiarizing.
A conversation on the oldest complete story that we have. It's called Gilgamesh. We'll talk about it with Ken H. Dixon. He has translated Gilgamesh for a new graphic novel called The Epic of Gilgamesh. That's next on Letters on Politics. But first, the news.
For Pacifica Radio, I'm Eileen Alfandari. In a year that saw global warming fueled wildfires, torrential rains, and catastrophic flooding, a new report says the world increased carbon emissions instead of reducing them. Three studies released at Climate Talks in Poland say world carbon dioxide emissions rose an estimated 2.7% from 2017 to 2018. It was the biggest jump in global warming emissions in 7 years. U.S. emissions rose by 2.5%, Chinese emissions by 4.6%. Scientists say the calculations put some of the 2015 Paris Climate Accord goals nearly out of reach. That's especially catastrophic for the global south, which has fewer resources to respond to the effects of global warming. Mohamed Addo is with Christian Aid. He says on the continent of Africa, 2 out of 3 people don't even have electricity. Addo called on the wealthy nations to make good on previous commitments of billions of dollars in aid to help the poorest countries adapt to climate change and adopt clean, green technology.
The opportunity to be able to tackle climate change exists. But what we're lacking is a political will that allows the global community to be able to cooperatively share the effort in a way that helps us to meet the 1.5 degree objective. So the cruel irony of climate change is the ones who've suffered the worst are the ones who are expected to contribute the most without actually being facilitated with climate finance and clean technology. And that can continue.
Addo spoke on the sidelines of the Poland climate talks. A bipartisan group of six senators has introduced a resolution that says Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman is complicit in the murder of journalist Jamal Khashoggi. It would put the Senate on record as officially condemning the prince, also known as MBS, for the murder of Khashoggi in the Saudi consulate in Istanbul, Turkey, in October. The resolution's authors are Republican Senator Lindsey Graham and Democratic Senator Dianne Feinstein. The resolution is largely symbolic, but would register the Senate's rebuke of the Trump administration's response. The resolution also holds the Crown Prince accountable for atrocities committed during the war in Yemen. Illinois Democratic Senator Dick Durbin spoke on CNN about pending Senate action on that issue.
Consider the fact that we have been supportive of the Saudis who invaded Yemen. We have given them targeting in terms of their bombing raids. At one point, we were fueling their bombers. That's got to come to an end. Absolutely. Not a single taxpayer's dollar, not a single American military life should be at risk on behalf of the Saudis in Yemen. It is a tragedy of epic proportions. Some 14 million people facing a famine, not to mention the thousands of children and hundreds of thousands of other innocent people who've died. We want the United States, those of us in this position, want the United States completely removed from that conflict.
The Senate could begin debate as early as Monday on the measure to force withdrawal of U.S. support for the Saudi-led war in Yemen. House Democratic Leader Nancy Pelosi says the chamber could take the extraordinary step of calling for a new election in a North Carolina congressional district if the winner is unclear amid allegations of voter fraud.
So House Administration Committee will have full investigative authority to determine the winner of the election. And again, only if it's impossible to determine who the winner is would we take the extraordinary step of calling for a new election. But that governing body can do so, because this is bigger than that one seat. This is about undermining the integrity of our elections. And what was done there is so remarkable, and that person, those entities got away with that.
Officials in North Carolina are investigating allegations of fraud. Republican Mark Harris leads Democrat Dan McCready by about 900 votes, but the results are not certified. The investigation centers on get-out-the-vote activities of McCrae Dowless, who worked as a contractor for Harris's chief campaign strategist. Dowless allegedly paid people to request absentee ballots from voters and then illegally collect them. In some cases, the paid workers may have filled the ballots out themselves. The campaign contractor apparently engaged in similar activity in a Republican primary. The family of George H.W. Bush will join a special train to carry the former president's casket to his final resting place. Bush's relatives left St. Martin's Episcopal Church in Houston following a funeral attended by about 1,200 mourners. I'm Eileen Alfandary. Letters and Politics is next.
Welcome to Letters on Politics. I'm Mitch Jezrich. The ancient story of Gilgamesh is the oldest long-form story that we have, dating back to potentially as early as 2500 BC. That's arguable, and we'll talk about those dates. It's from the eldest civilization that we know of, right there with Egypt, and that's Sumer, right between the Tigris and Euphrates River, which today is modern Iraq. Gilgamesh is a story about tyranny, sex, friendship, immortality, death, environmental destruction, and wisdom. It is an epic, nothing short than about a story of the journey of life itself. There are stories and symbols throughout the epic of Gilgamesh that could be found in the Old Testament, including the flood and also the serpent. And though debated, it's believed by most historians that the story of Gilgamesh is much older than the stories that we find in the Bible. So today we're going to be in conversation about this story, the story itself, and also its history. My guest is Kent H. Dixon. He is a translator of a new graphic novel that takes the words of Gilgamesh and puts them into pictures that were drawn by his son, Kevin H. Dixon. It's called The Epic of Gilgamesh. Kent H. Dixon, it's my very good pleasure to welcome you to this radio station. Thank you for being here.
Tremendous pleasure.
I'm excited to have this conversation. I've always wanted to have this conversation. Let's put the timing of this story of Gilgamesh, and it's not, we don't know exactly when it came out. There are wide estimates, and we could talk about that. But I think it's safe to say this, that the New Testament, the stories of Jesus, are probably closer to us in time right now than the stories of Jesus were to Gilgamesh.
By a factor of two,
yeah,
three, and even four.
Yeah.
Old Testament earliest is maybe 600, a little bit after Homer, 600 BC, Genesis and things like that. And where they get most of the Gilgamesh, the so-called standard version, is around 1200 BC. But there are pieces that they use to plug in and fill the missing pieces in the puzzle that go back to 2500, as you say. And if you push it, you can go into the beginning of Sumerian literature as early as 3500, 3800, when writing begins, actually.
So there are many, we have many historic examples of this story.
Yeah, all over.
And the one that we know of, the one where we get, and we don't have the entire story actually, but where we get the most story comes from these tablets, not from 2500 BC, but more like around somewhere between 1000 and 1300 BC.
Exactly.
What is that?
We were talking earlier, Ashurbanipal goes nuts and collects everything he can. And
Ashurbanipal is the king of Assyria, ancient Assyria.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Around, I think, 600.
Yeah, 600-700 BC, yeah. In that area.
And that's, they excavate that palace and that kingdom, 1872 is when they start finding it. And there's tremendous amount of stuff there. In fact, there are more tablets and fragments and complete untranslated today than all of classical literature translated, Greek and Roman.
Interesting. So these tablets, they were found at what we call Ashurbanipal's library.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I remember I went to the British Museum a couple of years ago, and I found collections of Ashurbanipal's library. And I never take photos of myself. It was the only time I've asked somebody to take my photo with me in it, with the library behind me. That's how excited I was to find it.
Yeah, I'm always running around with the huge statues that are 30 feet tall and having my wife, you know, shoot me there. You're a third as tall.
And so what Ashurbanipal did is, again, he was known for his library, and he must have collected these. So he had old books then, because, again, these tablets that were found there were predated Ashurbanipal.
Yeah,
it would almost
right.
be like, for him, if we had our library today, we had original texts of Shakespeare, I guess.
Mm-hmm. And then of course, copies of, and then they find pieces everywhere, and then they find pieces where the language is actually quite different from the standard version that they use. So they have to work that out. And for a long, long time, those were, you know, they're in Iraq, they're in Iran, they're in Paris, they're in Philadelphia, you know, they're in Chicago at the Oriental Museum. So a scholar would have to go all over the world to look at these originals and make the drawings of the cuneiform. And that slowed everybody down tremendously. Imagine that. So we mentioned him earlier. Andrew George comes along. He manages to go everywhere and touch base with every single place where these things are. So he pulled together the most thorough translation.
So the story of Gilgamesh that we have, again, it comes from these 12 tablets written somewhere between 1300 BC and 1000 BC. It's in cuneiform, the Akkadian language. But as you said, you go further back into the time of Sumer, as far back as 2500, maybe even further. We have what, then little examples that are actually in the original Sumerian language?
Don't think of cuneiform as a language.
It's a writing.
It's an alphabet.
Right. So it's a writing of Akkadian.
Well, it's Akkadian, it's Babylonian, it's Assyrian, it's the Hittite use it, the Edomite. Everybody used it. And it goes on for a long time. It goes actually on into about 70 or 100 A.D., people are still using it.
These are distant relatives of Arabic.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, no, not the cuneiform, but the
not cuneiform, but the
Assyrian
languages
is. Yeah, they're all Semitic languages,
yeah.
Except Sumerian. They don't know what that is, and that's very hard to translate.
So, when you put this story together, the Epic of Gilgamesh, Does one just use the 12 tablets, or are there other pieces of it that we have found that add to the story, or does it just confirm to this story?
There are other Gilgamesh stories out there. There's one where Ababu that is laying siege on his city, and all he does is stand up and loom over the rampart walls, and it scares the enemy away. Or the very nice one that Tablet 12 is stolen from. He's moseying along, and Ishtar wants this certain tree because she wants to make a throne out of it, but there's a demon in it. Gilgamesh chases the demon out. She rewards him with his stick and his puck, his Meku and his Puku, and then cut right there. That's the beginning of Tablet 12. Oh, that he hadn't gone to the carpenter's wife that day. Oh, that he lost his Puku and his Meku. That's this old Sumerian story of Gilgamesh cut in half because they wanted the underground journey much later on. It's probably added 1,000 years after the standard version that we're looking at.
Cuneiform, though, the word actually means wedge. And it's because you actually create a wedge into a clay tablet to write the language.
Imagine a flat piece of damp clay, and then you have a stylus, almost like a straw, a reed that's been sharpened down to a point. You press that point into the clay, and that makes the head of the wedge, the kind of nail-looking head, and then you drag it a certain length, and that gives you that little arrow pointing to the right.
And that's what they are, is a series of arrows when you're looking at.
Yeah, they look. I was
that's what
just,
it looks like.
We were at the beach yesterday, and the sandpipers are going along, and I looked down at those little footprints in the sand. I drew a big box around it and put a couple of cuneiform characters in it and said, "Hey, Ken Henry, my grandson, come here, look."
It's not an alphabet.
No. No, they're syllables.
They're syllables.
Yeah, and sometimes a syllable can be a word, cat, that works. So you use cat in catastrophe, in catalog, in anything where cat is going to go. You can use that little symbol for cat.
I mean, it's not hieroglyphics. It's not an alphabet.
It's better than hieroglyphic.
But is there any other kind of writing that you could think of that you can compare to cuneiform? Or is this
writing comes along out of the same design, the same method. You start with pictures. You draw a goat, and then you stylize that goat, and then after a while, three strokes represent that goat, and then you start using the word goat anywhere that G-O-A-T or G-O-T or G-E-T can fit. You have lots of options, and it slips all over because they don't care about those vowels. I and E and A are all interchangeable a lot of the time. Well, there's where misinterpretation goes and downright mistakes. You can find mistakes in every translation just by looking at the other translations and saying, uh-oh, this guy, why did he go that way? Then you can look up the actual word if you want and, hold that guy to the put his feet to the fire.
And then, we would get an alphabet from the Phoenicians, which is the same area. I mean, sort of geographic area.
But it develops the same way. That R-A, think of a capital A, is originally an ox upside down. Just draw the V and draw a line with it, and its two little horns are sticking up.
That's right.
It falls over on its side for a while, and then it winds up upside down, which is our right side up. It was called Aleph. We get the word alpha. And then the Greeks looked at the Phoenicians and used some of those symbols for vowel sounds, which the Phoenicians didn't. So it didn't really work as a great alphabet. The Greeks are the genius. They put the vowels in. Yeah. Anybody can read it.
So R-A is a bull.
Yeah.
Upside down.
Yeah. Yeah, they're wonderful.
Again, we are in conversation with Kent H. Dixon. He is a translator of a new graphic novel, along with his son, who is the illustrator, Kevin H. Dixon, and it is The Epic of Gilgamesh, and that is what we are in conversation about. Okay, let's get to the story of Gilgamesh. It's a great big story, and it even has, tell me about the beginning of this story. It has this sort of pronouncement, and it's longer than I'm going to quote here, of him who endured everything, him who they call Gilgamesh.
Well, the beginning, the actual opening line is Shan Nagma Imuru, Lesuedi, Maati, so forth. And it translates, he who saw everything. And it wasn't called the Epic of Gilgamesh. All these ancient myths and so forth were called by their first name. So it was known as he who saw everything, or he who knew everything, or finally, he who did everything. I think I plowed all of those meanings into my first page as much as I could. But what's interesting, it starts out with, like you're suggesting, with a narrator outside. And at a certain point, Gilgamesh seems to come in and take over the narrator. And you think of the Odyssey. You know, you think of Odysseus. He's going here and there. He's stuck with Circe. You know, and then he gets to Alcinous's island. And they finally say, who the hell are you? And somebody's trying to tell the story of Odysseus and the Battle of Troy, and he takes over, and he tells his own story. And, you know, how did Homer come about doing that?
Yeah, you're right. There's something to say Homer...
There it is, yeah.
...was influenced by Gilgamesh.
There's a lot in Homer that
what else?
Well, the Patroclus-Achilles relationship, Enkidu and Gilgamesh. Well, there's so many literary forms. In Tablet 12, I just took a course in the New Testament, and we wound up with Revelations, and I was reading up on apocalyptic literature. Tablet 12 actually follows the formal designs of apocalypticisms. So if you look in the book of Daniel, or you look at John's Revelation, or you look a couple of other places, there's Apocalypse of Peter. And you fudge it a little bit because they're going to God in their ultimate meaning, and the Gilgamesh isn't exactly. You've got the same shape. There's an apocalypse in 12 when he goes through how does the man who had one son fare in the underworld? How does the man who had three sons? How does the man, and Enkidu tells him about who everybody who's in the underworld and how he's doing, which isn't great. You know, you're eating dust and brick and clay and it's a bad place.
Let's talk about who Gilgamesh is. He's a king of ancient city of Sumer. I think it's Great Walls. And at the beginning, he's a serious tyrant.
Oh, he's terrible.
Yeah.
Yeah. He's young, and he's randy. He's oversexed. He's
what they call first rights.
Right.
He, as king, would sleep with all the brides before the husband would.
Yeah, and then think about that. Enkidu gets really mad at that when he hears about it and starts the fight. Doesn't let him go into the temple to meet a first night bride. Stops him. What priest is sticking his neck out against the overlords and the kings to find that a problem? You know, you start to see into the culture with moves like that in this.
And that's how we get to Enkidu. So you have this tyrant, Gilgamesh, who's really terrorizing his people of Ur.
Yeah, not only is he a first night rites, but he uses the young men. He keeps them from their fathers and working in the fields and stuff for his sport. So he wants to play all these field games, and he rides around on their shoulders or on their backs, hitting a ball and everything like that, so they can't go work in the fields. So he's just a mess. He's a bad king.
Yeah.
And his people complain to the gods.
To the gods.
And then the gods say, okay, we'll make him a companion. We'll take away some of his energy and focus him. And they put Enkidu together out of clay. And Enkidu comes along and then,
But he comes along in the forest or
yeah, it's a Garden of Eden. He's a complete wild man.
And he is a wild man. He is
absolutely
running with the animals.
Right.
As an animal.
At the head of the herd.
And so he's not a part of Ur yet. He hasn't met Gilgamesh yet.
He doesn't speak. He doesn't eat bread. He doesn't know beer.
Yeah.
He's never had sex.
And that's about to change.
They get a temple prostitute to go out there and seduce him. And they have sex for a week. And that begins to civilize him. He learns language out of that. On the way to Uruk, they feed him some bread with some shepherds. He nearly chokes to death. He doesn't like it, but they force him to do it. And then he gets drunk on beer. And if you do the sex and the bread and the beer and language, you've got civilized man.
Yeah. A scene that sticks with me with in Gilgamesh is then after the lovemaking that Shamat has with Enkidu, Enkidu goes to return to his wildlife, to return to the animals,
yeah,
and all the animals run from him
now. Enkidu is really, he's secretly the hero of the Gilgamesh, he's the human being. He starts in Nirvana. He's in Eden running with a gazelle. He then discovers a great human act of propagation and food and dance. They have fun together. And then he goes into society and he suffers everything. You know, he warns Gilgamesh about the monster. He knows about the monster. Gilgamesh completely chickens out in midstream when they're on their way to kill him. And then Enkidu reassures him. So he kind of reverses himself. So he's really smart. And then, alas, alack, he's the one that has to die, and he goes through all of that. He's got the epic journey,
yeah.
You know?
Yes, he does. So he gets back to Ur. He comes with Shamat, and they get back to Ur. And as you say, as Gilgamesh is going to sleep with to be bride, he stops Gilgamesh, and there's this huge fight between them.
Yes.
In which Gilgamesh actually wins after a long struggle.
Right.
But after this, and I've heard some people say Gilgamesh is, and I think it's accurate to say it's about many things. It's truly an epic. But it's about friendship and the importance of friendship. And after this major fight between Enkidu and Gilgamesh, they become like brothers.
They do become brothers. Gilgamesh's mother adopts him,
yeah.
and actually gives him a belly button because he doesn't have one, because he was made out of clay. You know, he's not of woman born. They almost slip personalities around sometimes. Enkidu becomes more of a hero. Enkidu really kills the bull of heaven more than Gilgamesh does. Gilgamesh seems to be able to take down the monster. When they get back from killing Humbaba and they're washing off the gore, Ishtar, the goddess of love, spies Gilgamesh in his nakedness and propositions him. And Gilgamesh sits back and says, wait a minute, you don't have a very good record.
Because she's the god of love, but also the god of violence, too,
yeah, right.
Isn't she?
She's god of war, yeah.
Yeah, god of war.
So she's deeply insulted and calls down the bull of heaven. And they fight with the bull of heaven, and that's terrible. This bull is immense, and it digs a pit, and 100 men fall in, and he destroys half the city and so forth. They manage to take him down. Then as they're celebrating that, Enkidu tears off the thigh of the bull and heaves it into Ishtar's face. And that's probably what, you know, gets him voted down by the gods. For one thing, Gilgamesh is two-thirds divine, one-third human. It's a little bit harder to make him sick and die.
Right.
So they go after Enkidu, and there he goes. Both, it takes an entire tablet.
After they kill the bull, they anger the gods.
Yeah.
They kill Enkidu through illness.
12 days he thrives in sweating and you know, coma and in and out and having dreams. And Gilgamesh is going nuts at bedside. And then he dies. And then another tablet 7. Tablet 8 is Gilgamesh mourning him and having statues built and making all of nature mourn him and so forth. So not until 9 does Gilgamesh hit the road.
All of tablet 8 is
all of 8 mourning. Is just mourning. And all of 7 is dying.
Wow.
Yeah. So,
and Enkidu's death really is an existential crisis for Gilgamesh.
Yeah.
Because now he's facing death himself. He's not about to die at that moment, but now he knows he's going to die.
He has that great moment. I don't know when it comes for people, but, you know, there is a line you cross, maybe in your teens, maybe in your 20s, maybe not till you're 35, where it becomes more real than it ever was. And you think, oh, gee, this has to end. You know, okay, you can go and be tremendously religious and have that faith. You can work like mad to leave great works behind. You can have lots and lots of children and grandchildren. Who knows? But, you make your effort, and then you're gone. Utnapishtim has a wonderful line. He just brings up a dragonfly, and he says, it's a dragonfly there, and it's gone into the sun. That's life, you know.
And I want to get into Utnapishtim in just a moment here.
Mm-hmm.
But I just want to really, because he's going to find Utnapishtim, who's this man who has
a so on
life.
The way, it suddenly occurs
but
to
he's
me.
Wanderer. He becomes a wanderer.
He has this iron cold thought, I too may die. And that's kind of a turning point in the epic. So he's no longer quite mourning Enkidu. He's slipped that into his own mourning, his own life, his own the mortality.
It almost reminds me of the story of the Buddha when Siddhartha escapes from his
his palace where he was going to be king and becomes an aesthetic and becomes a wanderer himself. I mean, that's what I was thinking when I was reading that in Gilgamesh.
Yeah, yeah.
And so he goes on a quest to find the only immortal man that is on earth, and that's Utnapishtim. Who's Utnapishtim?
He was a king of and a priest and a scribe. Actually, in the beginning, the gods make humans to... What do? They take a young god, kill him, and out of his body make about seven human beings. These propagate very fast, and it gets to be immense, and they get very loud. And the head of the gods, Enlil, it disturbs his sleep, and he decides to get rid of them. And he tries everything. He tries drought. He tries disease. And finally, he comes up with this flood idea.
That's funny. I mean, again, there become too many people. They're too loud. They're disturbing the gods.
Yeah.
So they bring in a flood to wipe out the people.
Enki, this one god who's very human-friendly, whispers to a reed hut what's going to happen. This reed hut happens to belong to Utnapishtim, and he overhears it. And he says, reed hut, build you an ark, get the hell out of here, it's going to rain forever, you know, and so forth. And Utnapishtim gets everybody to, says, I am bad for you. The gods don't like me anymore. Build me an ark so I can get out of here. So he lies, fools everybody. They build this great ark, and then the rains come and everybody drowns. And this is horrible storm.
But there are people that say this is where we get the story in the Bible of the flood.
Oh, for sure.
No doubt.
No doubt. I mean, letting go the dove that comes back, and then the raven finally that doesn't, that finds dry land somewhere. And so some of the language is the same in Genesis and the story of Noah. Utnapishtim gets called the Babylonian Noah, you know, by everybody, by the scholars. Yeah, it's the flood. And when it was first published in 1872, that was the tablet that Smith published, and it caused riots. People threw bricks through the windows of the newspaper that published it because it implied that the Bible is plagiarizing. You know?
Right, right. That was a big deal.
They didn't like that, you know. But, you know, because this is the Word of God. And wait a minute, the Word of God is 1,500 years earlier, and you don't have anything about a Yahweh in this, you know, pantheon of gods. Whoops.
I also read that you can find from Ecclesiastics in the Bible just passages that almost look as though they are directly lifted from Gilgamesh.
It's not almost. It's exact.
Is it?
Yeah. Two or three lines are exact of what you can, as close as you can get to the Siduri's advice to Gilgamesh. You know, this is the real secret of life. It's my favorite passage. I love it.
So who is she? And what does she say?
Siduri is the alewife out on the edge of civilization, and he comes clomping along a real mess, wearing just lion skins and everything. She lets him in, and finally he tells her his story, and she begins to believe he's who he says he is. So at one point she gives him advice. Gilgamesh, trust me, you won't find what you seek. There's no point to your wandering. It cannot quench this thirst for life everlasting. The glorious gods, they created mankind, but with life they also gave it away, keeping eternal life safe in their unearthly clutches. Now there's an answer to this. It's your stomach, your liver, your heart, and your skin. Here, drink, eat, fill up thy stomach. Tonight, take pleasure. Tomorrow, take pleasure. Look about. All these happy, inconsiderate things, peel back their secret. Today's a holiday. It's all a holiday when you live. Invite people to your party. Dance with them. Laugh. Dance in your heart. Put on some clothes, fresh linen. Imagine caressing the skin. And as for that, and clean hair, take thee the wee child by the hand. Can you see it? It's yours. It's you. It's eternal, not this. In God's name, let me give you a bath. A wife would delight in your embrace, take joy in your lap. This, Gilgamesh, is how man and also woman live life.
This part of Gilgamesh
is... But that eat, drink, and be merry is right there in Ecclesiastes.
Eat, drink, and be merry.
Yeah, yeah.
This part of Gilgamesh and his searching for, because he has to go over it's not easy to find Utnapishtim. But this whole part about him trying to find Utnapishtim and then finding him and talking to Utnapishtim is my favorite part of this story, because this is where, to me, the real wisdom comes in on issues of life and death.
Yeah, well, hers. I mean, she's got the philosophy.
And also, he finds her first.
Mm-hmm. But Utnapishtim has plenty of wisdom. He's nastier about it. You know, I mean, he's got it, and Gilgamesh isn't going to get it. It's a little tedious for him, and he kind of slams him around. He gives him a test that he knows he'll fail, and he does fail. He gives him the gift of eternal youth. You can have youth as long as you live. You can have a young body, you know, be a 20-year-old man, woman. And it's a plant. Gilgamesh gets it. And then on the way home, he puts it down to take a bath. And a snake comes along and steals it. And as the snake slithers off, it sheds its skin. In other words, it's staying young, right?
Right.
It's a sort of etiological myth there. And at that point, Gilgamesh gives up. He says, I'm not going back. And he goes back to Uruk, taking the boatman with him. And then pauses at the hills and starts bragging about the walls that he built. And he's reaching for that as his immortality, you know, the great works. I think that's ironic. I don't think that's the answer. I think you sadden for Gilgamesh there. And I love it that Tablet 12 comes along. Bang.
Let's get into that in a moment.
We'll
get into 12 in a second.
Yeah. Go back to Ecclesiastes. I wouldn't say that it's all about eat, drink, and be merry. What happens with Ecclesiastes, the preacher, is he looks at life and he looks how hemmed in it is by things more powerful than you, about death, by this and that and the other thing. And he says, really, the only answer is to make the most of what you've got with your sensual body and so forth. So he's not a hedonist at all. He's saying this is the fallback position, which I never knew. I thought it was ironic. And the preacher Ecclesiastes was holding it up as what people believe, but this isn't true. You need to love God, da, da, da. It's not. He's saying this is the fallback position.
Enjoy your life.
Yeah.
Enjoy what you have.
Yeah. As cynical as he is.
Nobody lives forever.
Right? You know, Ecclesiastes, vanity, vanity, all is vanity.
Let's talk about Tablet 12. And what I appreciate about your book of Gilgamesh is that you include Tablet 12. Other translations I have read of it do not include Tablet 12. And I think it's because suddenly Enkidu is back alive, as though we never left in the first place, and no explanation for it.
Well, he's a little different. He's very deferential, and he seems more like a servant than the bosom buddy. And he's kind of an idiot. He comes along and says, I'll go down there and get your sports equipment for you. And Gilgamesh gives him a long list. Okay, if you go down there, don't do this, 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 and this. He goes down there and he does all of those. The underworld just clamps him down and he's stuck. Gilgamesh goes to two or three or four gods trying to get him out, arguing for him. And nobody will even listen to him, turns their back. And then he gets to Enki, that god that warned Utnapishtim about the flood. And Enki talks to Shamash, the sun god, and says, couldn't you knock a rent in your tunnel? See, the sun goes over the earth, and then it travels back in a tunnel through the night. And that's how it circulates. And Shamash does, and Enkidu pops up. And then you get that long passage of, well, what's the underworld like? Here's the people that had one son, two sons, seven sons.
Sinleki Unimi. This is the author of the tablets.
His name is on the bottom of the standard version in a couple of places. Thus ends he who saw everything by, in effect, Sinleki Unini. He was a priest. Sin means the moon. He's a priest for the moon. And I forget what Leki Unini means. One who worships. So he's a priest. He's a scribe. And he gets credit for pulling it together, just as Homer gets credit for taking you know, or the Homeric tradition of pulling in all these stories and making them coherent.
And the part of the problem with Tablet 12 and understanding how do we get to having Enkidu around again is that there are parts of it missing that are missing. The beginning of it actually is missing.
Well, it's just lopped off.
It's just lopped off, yeah, on the
yeah,
tablet.
Yeah, but you can find it. I mean, those are Sumerian tablets. In fact, I looked at one of those tablets in Philadelphia.
Kent Dixon, what does this story, the Epic of Gilgamesh, mean for you? Well, why have you spent so much time having to learn at least partially the cuneiform to be able to do this?
Well, I started with, that's a really stupid question. I'm going to die too, and it makes him cold in his heart because I thought I knew that at 22. Well, you know, at 32, 42, 52, it changes. At 72, it's really changed. And, why not? That's the question to start with. What are you going to do with your life if it's going to stop and that's it? And, you know, the three deaths, you know, with the three deaths, right? You drop dead, then that's one. Number two, they have a service for you and say nice things and bury you. That's your second death. The third death is when everyone and everything on earth has forgotten you and you're oblivion. That's the third death. And, you know, who knows anything about Senlaki Unini or...
And that's the story of Gilgamesh. The story of Gilgamesh is you're going to die. You better live. Seems simple. This is the earliest story of that we have.
And it's really implied that he can get back now and be a good king, having gone through all this. What's the point otherwise? It's not like he's as stupid as he ever was or as arrogant. There isn't a line that helps you jump to that. I think you have to know it. There's theories that certainly somebody is reading this because nobody could read it except the scribes and a few kings. And so a reader... Like, I've got a whole idea about Homer, that as Homer would chant this stuff, he would take characters, and there's some scenes in Homer where if you move around a little bit, you can have characters overhearing what other characters are saying, just how you move on the stage. I just think he might have been doing that. But they even go beyond that and said this might have been performed. So somebody is reading it, and there's actors doing certain things. Maybe in that, you know, maybe in the visual comic version, you can get to that answer, that he's a reformed king, that he's learned, and that just being the master of these great walls and the great works isn't the whole answer.
Because that's how these stories were told in the ancient world. They were spoken. They were performed.
Maybe. I mean, they don't know. Nobody's said it. But that's a good bet, and they certainly were spoken.
Yeah,
you know, nobody could read it. Homer, they don't have any alphabet for Homer, right? It's not written down, so it's all memorized, probably a chapter at a time.
Kent H. Dixon has been our guest again. Kent H. Dixon is a translator of a new graphic novel, The Epic of Gilgamesh, and the illustrations are done by his son, Kevin H. Dixon. Kent Dixon, I thank you for doing this, and I thank you for being here and having this conversation on this wonderful story.
On and on. I could do it. I'll come back tomorrow. We'll do the next four next four chapters.
I have to return to, yeah. No, to Homer.
I loved it, Mitch. It's great.
In telling the story of the Epic of Gilgamesh, I think it's worth noting the tragic story of George Smith, who was able to bring much of this story together. Finding these tablets back in 1872 was one of the most important archaeological finds of the 19th century. Again, the oldest complete form of an epic that we have. I believe it's around 5,000 years old. That's 1,000 years before the Old Testament was brought together. And it would also be, in part, some of the controversy and difficulty that George Smith would run into, because stories like the flood in Gilgamesh is really the same story of the flood, Noah's Ark, that you get in the Old Testament. Whole sections of Gilgamesh were basically lifted from it and put right into the Old Testament's Ecclesiastics. So it was controversial and offensive to the Christian sentiment of the day. And there was a big backlash against it when it occurred. And George Smith would die just a couple of years later. Actually, again, while he was excavating for Ashurbanipal's library, the king of Assyria, around 600-700 B.C. Fascinating for folks who are in San Francisco. You actually have a big, beautiful statue of Ashurbanipal just between the San Francisco Library and the Asian Art Museum down at Civic Center Plaza. Worth seeing. It has cuneiform written all over it if you want to see what that looks like. You are listening to Letters on Politics. I'm Mitch Jezerich, and we are in a very short end-of-the-year fund drive in which we pass around our cap to see if people will support here at the end of the year our year-end performance. Now, the money that is raised in these fund drives is money that makes shows like this one and everything else here on this radio station possible. I've always seen this hour like our stage, a stage in which through conversation we tell the stories of the world. And while some days will always be better than others, our goal is always the same, to bring a conversation to the air that is educational, interesting, and if we're lucky, may take you away to a different time and a different place for a little while. And now is the time that we come back to you and we ask you if you appreciate what we have done in this past year, that you gently hear and kindly judge our play with a donation that is reasonable for you, one that is responsible for you, one that you can feel good about as you go upon your day afterwards. $25 pledge will make you a member of this radio station. We do have thank you gifts, and the thank you gifts include this graphic novel that was translated by Kent H. Dixon, who was our guest, and Kevin H. Dixon, who is Kent's son and the animator of it. And what I really liked about this graphic novel of the epic story of Gilgamesh is you get to see these great walls of Uruk. You get to see and sort of visualize this story as you go through with it, and is very faithful to the actual epic story in itself. So for a pledge of $100, our thank you gift to you is this graphic novel, The Epic of Gilgamesh. Also for a pledge of $100, we have the end of the year Best of 2018 Letters and Politics History Pack. This is 18 interviews throughout the year that I think highlight mostly what I've been trying to do on this program in this past year, and that is analyze the rise and fall of civilizations and what are the historic drivers behind the different dynamics that I hope help us inform ourselves about our world today. They include interviews like what we played earlier in this week with Neil Faulkner. He wrote the book called A Radical History of the World. Or James C. Scott, also about the very earliest civilizations and the invention of slavery in order to keep people in cities, which were at one time kind of terrible places to live, full of disease and filth. But in order to keep these people together, to create the surplus that a civilization would need, that the kings would need, we end up getting slavery. Also includes our entire conversation that we had with Kent Dixon on the epic story of Gilgamesh, our conversation with Paul Cartledge on ancient Athenian democracy 2,500 years ago, and what were the social currents that created that, and how did they come up with it, and what did that look like? Arthur Eckstein about how democracies and republics fall apart into chaos and despotism in the ancient world. Kyle Harper about how climate change may have played a very important role in the fall of the Roman Empire, and with great volcanic eruptions, and how it changed the atmosphere. Catherine Nixie on the destruction of the classical world. Erica Brenner on Machiavelli, which is really interesting. Yana Varoufakis, the conversation we had about democracy in the classical world and the democracy we have today. Catherine Gerbner on the history of slavery and how slavery changed fundamentally after Europeans found the Americas, and how it became a race-based system. Jason Stanley on how fascism works. David Graeber on the history of time and labor. Timothy Snyder on tyranny. Stephen Greenblatt on the politics of Shakespeare and why it matters today. And a whole lot more is part of that pack. That is yours on an MP3 CD for a pledge of $100. So The Epic of Gilgamesh, the book, $100. The Best of Letters and Politics for 2018, $100. There is also the Letters and Politics, we call it the Mundo Pack. And for a $200 pledge, what you get is a sizable USB drive that you plug into your computer, and it has every history pack we have ever offered is in this. And that's about 200 interviews, probably about 150 hours worth of material. That is yours for a pledge of $200. You can get the USB drive with all of our history packs and the book, The Epic of Gilgamesh, at the discounted rate of $225. So here's how it works. We are on KPFA in Northern California. We are also on KFCF in the Central Valley. And we're on KPFK in Southern California. We are all in our end of the year fund drive. And we want to make sure that your donation gets to your radio station. So I have to give you a couple of numbers to make sure that happens. First, for listeners in Northern California and Central Valley listening to KPFA and also KFCF, the phone number is 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. Or online at kpfa.org. And for our friends listening to KPFK in Southern California, that phone number is 818-985-5735. 818-985-5735 or online at kpfk.org. Again, for a pledge of $100, and you are supporting your radio station that relies on listener support to function. We don't air commercials. We don't accept corporate underwriting. We rely entirely upon you. It's what allows us to have these type of, I think, of intellectual explorations into our world. And we rely on you for us to, so for us to be able to do that into the new year, we're going to need your support right now. $100 pledge. Our thank you gift is this fantastic Epic of Gilgamesh graphic novel. It is a graphic novel, so you get pictures that come with it of the imaginations of Kevin H. Dixon. But you also get the entire story together. It's a great teaching tool. Even the kids may very much appreciate getting this ancient story. That's yours for a pledge of $100. The Letters and Politics Best of 2018 History Pack, $100. Our Mondo Pack, all of our history packs that we've ever done since the, not since the beginning of time, but at least the beginning of time of this radio program, you get that on a USB drive for a pledge of $200, and you can get that and the, and that, this is a pretty good deal, actually, if you think about it. For $225, you get both the USB drive as well as the book together at $225. The phone number is one, if you are listening to KPFA, 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. And online at kpfa.org. And if you're listening in Southern California to KPFK, that number is 818-985-5735. 818-985-5735 or online at kpfk.org. My friends, we have raised about $125 so far this hour. We have just 9 minutes remaining in the hour, and we have six people calling in at least to KPFA. So we have to try to pick this up a little bit. If you think it's important to have a radio station like this, if you think it's important to have a book in your hands that will give you the oldest complete story we have, which influenced the Bible, what influenced probably Homer. I think it probably influenced, if you look into Norse mythology and, Odin, the god who gave up his eye and wandered the earth in order to try to find wisdom. And if you see a connection to that and Gilgamesh wandering the earth after the death of Enkidu,
I see a connection there too. I didn't talk about that with Kent Dixon, but I see that connection when I look at that story. Sort of this wanderer. I've heard the wanderer is also a very much the wandering God looking for wisdom is also very influential in the wizard, right? The old wizard, Gandalf, even in The Lord of the Rings. The phone number is 1-800-439-5732. If you're listening to KPFA in Northern California, 1-800-439-5732 or online at kpfa.org. In Southern California, it's 818-985-5735. 818-985-5735 or online at kpfk.org. I just got this from the phone room, and it's four letters in politics. And it is $1,000 challenge from our fellow listeners. Michelle in Sebastopol and Gavin in Berkeley are willing to put up $1,000 right now. And that's a good chunk of money. That would actually help us a lot, catapult us forward here. But it's conditional. It's based on whether or not we can raise an additional $1,000 from you. In other words, 10 people calling in and pledging to get the Epic of Gilgamesh, or 10 people calling in getting the Letters in Politics History Pack, whatever it is. If we can make that happen right now, your donation can be doubled in our final 7 minutes together right now. But if we can't do that, we do have to offer Michelle and Gavin their money back. These are two fellow listeners that are trying to do their part. They can make a sizable contribution to this radio station right now. But it's only you don't want to put on $1,000 if the show's not going to be there next month, the radio station's not going to be there next year. It's an investment. And so they're trying to galvanize other they're trying to actually force my hand here to try to do a better job, but they're also trying to galvanize other listeners too, to try to help us raise this money to keep this historic radio station on the air. So the challenge begins now, an opportunity for you to be able to double your donation to your radio station in Northern California on KPFA. The phone number is 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732 and online at kpfa.org. In Southern California, it's 818-985-5735, 818-985-5735, or online at kpfk.org. If you appreciate the approach that we do on this program with fundraising, and that is trying to bring a show that's worth your time, a show that hopefully you've tuned in for, one that is educational, one that I hope enlarges horizons, trying to understand circumstances and people of different times and different places. That's what we try to do during these fund drives. But if we aren't able to make our goal, our fundraising goal, because this doesn't come out of just nothing, does cost a little bit of money to keep the lights on in order for us to be able to work on these programs. No one at these radio stations are getting rich. It is definitely a labor of love. Some of us get paid. We're fortunate enough for that to happen, but we can't, you know, we can't make it work without your support. And this is how we can measure if there is an appetite out there for, even though, and there's nothing wrong with a fund drive, right? This is how we make it happen. This is how it works. This is how we maintain our independence. This is why we don't have to play commercials or take corporate underwriting or be beholden to corporations that are looking to find consumers out there to buy their products in order to help them meet their corporate bottom line. We bypass that completely by relying just on the listener. But if this model doesn't work, then, well, we have to shake it up and try to do something else that might, I don't know, that might be more effective. 1-800-439-5732. That's the phone number if you want to pledge to KPFA. 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. Or online, you can pledge online at kpfa.org. If you are listening in Southern California, that number is 818-985-5735, 818-985-5735.
5735 or online at kpfk.org. We are now $300 towards that $1,000 challenge. We have 3 minutes remaining in the hour. I think this is also a fine time to make that end of the year contribution. Might be that final opportunity that you can make that end of the year contribution and have it, you know, count towards reducing your taxes a little bit. You know, it is deductible up to the fullest amount allowed under the law. So this is your maybe one of your last times you can get that charitable contribution in there and have it count towards your taxes to support a public broadcasting radio station rather than perhaps supporting more war or supporting the military. The phone number is 1-800-439-5732 in Northern California on KPFA. 1-800-439-5732 or online kpfa.org. You can also pledge to your radio station in Southern California, if that's where you're listening to KPFK, 818-985-5735, 818-985-5735, or online at kpfk.org. We are now $450 towards that $1,000 challenge, my friends. We have not yet made it. My goodness, you could be one of those folks that help us get to that $1,000 challenge and double that towards our hourly goal, which would help us immensely right now. Because if we can't make this work, if we can't do it through this model, I got to rethink it. There are responsibilities that I have to do. It is dependent upon us. We have a very nice, sizable audience in large part because we're between a couple of great programs, Democracy Now! And the Talkies with Chris Welch, right? So we're the beneficiaries of that. But if I can't make this hour work with the listenership that we have at this time, then we may have to bring back the bells and whistles, you know, the dial for dollars kind of a thing, you know. But I've always hoped that we could do it this way. 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. If you are listening in the Bay Area or Northern California or Central California, you can also pledge kpfa.org. And then Southern California, 818-985-5735. 818-985-5735. Online at kpfk.org. Mary V. in Boulder Creek, thank you so much. Judith in Lambertville, could never do this without you, Judith. Bob in Pleasant Hill, Haifa in Culver City, thank you. Friends, 30 seconds to go. 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732 in the Bay Area, online at kpfa.org. And in Southern California, 818-985-5735. 818-985-5735 or online at kpfk.org.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Coming up next,
TUC Radio.
TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. Vandana Shiva, Soil, Not Oil. This is the keynote speech by the Indian physicist, ecologist, seed collector, anti-GMO and Monsanto campaigner, teacher of organic agriculture, author, and founder of many vibrant organizations. Just to mention one, Navdanya is serving more than 500,000 farmers, teaches organic farming, and established 60 seed banks in 16 states across India. In a life spanning local action and international politics, academic teaching and gardening alongside her rural neighbors, Vandana Shiva has become an inspiration to many. Her books include Stolen Harvest, Earth Democracy, Biopiracy, The Plunder of Nature and Knowledge, Water Wars, and Soil Not Oil. This book, first published in 2007, has become influential beyond its initial success because it addresses the most urgent issue of our time, climate change. As we are becoming more aware that industrial agriculture is a major cause of greenhouse gas emissions that bring about climate change, Vandana Shiva and others are now making the case that restoring the soil and recovering organic agriculture around the world can not only dramatically limit climate change, but even has the capacity to sequester carbon back into the soil that has already been emitted into the air. In September 2015, a two-day conference took place in Richmond, California. They discussed this timely potential in more detail. In honor of Vandana Shiva, the conference and organization were named Soil, Not Oil, and she was asked to give the keynote address. Here she is, Vandana Shiva.
Thank you very much. And thank you, Miguel, for everything you did to make the Soil Not Oil conference happen. I wrote Soil Not Oil because I realized that even though an industrial agriculture model was such a big part of the problem of climate change, agriculture was totally missing from the discussion on climate change. That what we are talking about really is our role on this beautiful earth, our role either to be passive, because I don't think any of us are big players in the destruction, but we do lend support to that system when we don't break away from it. First in our minds and our hearts, and then through the actions that we take, through the way we live. And Soil Not Oil came so naturally to me to say, we have lived for about 2.5 centuries in an age of oil, which built on 500 years of the age of colonialism. But it aggravated every trend of colonization. There would be no oil empire today without wars. Oil means wars. The age of oil is the age of wars for oil and for other resource grabs. Because it's only with the age of oil that it became possible to expand the footprint anywhere. If the British hadn't shifted their production on the basis of coal, the earlier stage of fossil fuels, they wouldn't have been able to come to this land to grow cotton. It's those machines that ran on coal that had such a huge appetite. The spinning wheel that Gandhi spun had a limited appetite. So the land was taken from the Native Americans, and then the big cotton plantations need workers. Africans were grabbed, brought to this country as slaves. India had to be colonized for her cotton as well as indigo. And the entire colonial expansion was driven first by fossil fuels in the form of coal and then oil. The age of oil should get over, so the age of soil can begin. We know now, after being fooled for about 75 years, that the soil is the most amazing living ecosystem, most diverse, more diverse than the plants that we see above the soil or the fish in the ocean, the microorganisms. We are still trying to catch up with what's going on in the soil. And because we built our economics, our politics, our cosmology around oil. Industrialism begins with fossil fuels. The entire thinking in terms of a fragmented mindset, in terms of a separation from nature, a separation within nature, all of that is a result of the fact that we could ignore the vibrant ecological cycles of the earth and imagine that we could cheat nature with fossil fuels. We created an entire scientific and technological edifice to help us with that cheating. But beyond a point, the limits come and hit. Climate change is one of those limits where planetary boundaries are being broken, but the consequences are real and they are huge. A second consequence was the way we've defined the economy. I get so surprised when they talk about efficiency and productivity in agriculture. How can industrial agriculture, which uses 10 times more inputs as energy to provide one calorie of food, be called efficient? It is so inefficient that if any other sector worked on that logic, it would collapse. The reason industrial agriculture carries on inefficiently is because it is subsidized at every level. It's subsidized through subsidies to the fossil fuel industry. It is subsidized through subsidies to chemical fertilizers that are based on fossil fuels. My own country in 2008 was giving so much subsidy. It was nearly a trillion rupees of subsidy to nitrogen fertilizers. And that was more than our defense budget. And where does that subsidy go? To the Cargills? Where did the fertilizers come from? In the soil, they come from the amazing microorganisms, from the earthworms, from all of the richness of life. Nitrogen fertilizers made synthetically come from the same factories that made explosives during the war. It's inefficient in other ways. But the trick is, you've totally redefined the economy. And, you know, I sometimes do get amazed at the human species, that we can be taken to such levels of stupidity. For centuries on end, and we accept it. Take the stupidity of measuring productivity in agriculture on the basis of reducing human beings in farming. Wendell Berry has written this beautiful essay of farmland without farmers. Farmers are carers and stewards of the seed and the soil and the climate. And that's the most important point, farmers and gardeners. They're definitely not producers of commodities. They're producers of nourishment. Very often the debate will come up and people say, oh, but organic is costly. And I remind them about the subsidies, $400 billion annually, or more than $1 billion a day, to make costly oil-based food. We literally are eating oil, as I've written in my book, Soil, Not Oil. We're eating oil. Normally, the measure in industrial agriculture based on fossil fuels is yield per acre. And yield only measures the commodity that left the farm. It doesn't measure the output, the diversity that you can grow on the farm. It doesn't measure the health of the soil, the richness of biodiversity, whether your soils have the ability to conserve moisture or not, an issue that is so relevant today in California. You know, with 0.5% organic matter in soil, we can have 80,000 liters per hectare of water in the soil. We wouldn't experience drought. We see that all the time in our farms. In the same area with the same drought, the organic farms are producing food. And the chemical farms, called the Green Revolution farms in India, have absolute crop failure. With 1%, you can hold 100,000 liters, and with 5%, 800,000 liters. So the answer to drought is the same answer to nourishment and health, because industrial agriculture has produced nutritionally empty commodities loaded with toxics. And the damage to health is twofold, because of the micronutrient deficiencies on the one hand, but the toxics on the other. And if we start to internalize those costs, we just couldn't afford farming with oil and eating oil. It would just be too costly for our bodies and the planet. We would pack it up. And we will have to pack it up, because we are the ones who, with the earth, are paying the full price. We then decided last year, we said, let's really assess what's happening with the hidden costs, external costs of chemical farming in India. And the two big costs we took into account were environmental costs. So the government does maintain data on how much soil has been eroded. They maintain data on how many bird deaths took place because of pesticide poisoning. So we took all of that data from official sources, and we added to it the data on something new we've seen as a result of the age of oil in agriculture: farmers committing suicide. So the figures in India, according to official statistics, have crossed 300,000. The suicides began in the cotton area, and it began after Monsanto started to monopolize the cotton seed by illegal means. I have a very long article on my website on how Monsanto wrote and broke laws to dominate India's cotton supply. They collected royalties without even having a patent. The price of seed jumped 80,000%. No farmer can afford it. Debt is inevitable, and all the suicides are related to debt. But this spring, just as we were getting ready to celebrate our harvest festival in April, we had untimely rain, which is another aspect of climate change. We had hailstorms, hail that big, and the entire crop in northern India was destroyed, except in the farms that were growing native seeds and doing organic farming. And I only know this because farmers who are members of Navdanya would call me up and said, Didi, you know, in India we make everyone our relation, and I'm the elder sister. And they'd say, Didi, I used the old seeds, and my wheat is standing tall. But farmers who had been trapped into using chemicals, using the new varieties designed to use chemicals, they're not miracle varieties. They're basically carriers of toxics. Transiting beyond oil is vital to human survival. The planet will survive somehow. She'll have different life forms. She might have a different temperature. But she'll carry on. We are too small to threaten her life. But we are able, in our small-mindedness, to destroy the amazing conditions for our species that Gaia has offered us. The right temperature, the right kinds of plants, and all she asks of us in return is a little service to the soil. That's all we have to do. Give back to the soil with love. Remember, we are part of the soil, that we are the soil. And the rest she takes care of. In all these years of doing ecological agriculture, I've decided to not use the word food production. We use the word soil regeneration. Because food is a gift the earth gives back to us in return for our gift of love and labor and care, for giving back soil fertility. And that is exactly what, at the scientific level, is closing the carbon cycle. The carbon cycle has been ruptured because we are digging deep into the earth, pulling out the fossil fuels, burning them up at a very high level. And while the earth has an amazing capacity to take the carbon dioxide emitted through natural processes and absorb it again through natural processes, the most amazing being photosynthesis, of taking the carbon dioxide out of the air, putting it in the plant, through the plant into the soil, and we join up and increase the organic matter, intensify the biodiversity, return part of it to the soil, sustain ourselves, but also sustain other species. So we've been just giving back to the earth in every way we can. And one of the things that I haven't managed to really measure yet, but I see it every day on our farm, the dwarf varieties of the Green Revolution hardly give you any organic matter and therefore block your return of carbon. Older varieties are that tall. The millet varieties are huge. We have saved a rice variety that grows 18 feet tall in the floodwaters of Bihar. And of course, Bill Gates, who loves to work to promote Monsanto, has just written a piece, which my colleague Ruchi was sharing with me, saying how he is bringing to Bihar, through innovation, flood-tolerant rices. You cannot genetically engineer flood tolerance. You cannot genetically engineer drought tolerance. You cannot genetically engineer salt tolerance. These are complex traits where many genes act together. Genetic engineering is such a crude technology, it can only introduce one gene through a gene gun. It is not able to understand the relationships of the entire genome in all its complexity and all its capacity to self-organize and self-regulate. So with organic farming, the measures in Doon Valley on our organic farms are 2.2 tons per hectare. The figures are available now that with a 2 tons per hectare increase in organic matter, which I call it a thank you to the earth and the soil. It's just our thank you for supporting us. We could pull out 10 gigatons from the atmosphere. Through organic farming, we don't just reduce the 40% greenhouse gases we've pumped up. We do more. We pull out the stocks that have accumulated. If we say, if each of us commits ourselves, that whatever is the land on which our lives depend, either directly as gardeners or directly as farmers, or indirectly through the food we eat, we are going to make sure that our living on this planet returns to the earth the carbon that belongs to her. And the beauty of it is, it doesn't just address the climate crisis. It addresses the health crisis, which is coming from eating oil. It addresses the crisis of other aspects of the ecological problem, the water crisis, the desertification, the biodiversity extinction and erosion. But I think most of all, it allows us to reclaim Earth democracy. It allows us to play an active role to truly deserve the citizenship of this beautiful planet. So when I talk about soil, not oil, I'm really talking about the birthing of an earth democracy. A birthing of an earth democracy with us celebrating what Richard Heinberg has called the powering down in terms of fossil fuel, shedding that extra baggage that has been imposed on us through illusion after illusion after illusion. And while we power down in fossil fuels, we power up in our own capacities to make change, our capacity to live better by consuming less of the earth. And, you know, since I am in a part of the world which has deep poverty as well as huge wealth, and I also work with the government of Bhutan on this transition to 100% organic Bhutan, and Bhutan has said we will not measure GDP, which is also a part of this age of oil. Because the age of oil very cleverly said, the more you destroy nature and turn it into commodities, the more growth you have. The more you destroy society and its ability to provide for itself and make it dependent on buying its junk food, its bottled water, the more growth you have. The more sick the people are, and the more drugs have to be bought from the same companies that also gave us the sickness through the poisons. We mustn't forget that those who want to control the seed today are the same industries that have been the ones pushing poisons in farming, the agrichemicals, and are the same companies that made those chemicals for war. That agriculture has become a war against the planet and our bodies is not an accident. Its origins are war. And the new birthing we have to do very consciously, very collectively, in solidarity, not just amongst ourselves, but across species. And that's the beauty of our times. That while cultures have existed, my own culture gave me the word Vasudheva Kutumbakam, the earth has a family. Chief Seattle said, we are part of the web of life, not outside it. Pachamama, no matter where you look in the world, cultures realize we were part of the earth family. The age of oil for 250 years has tried to make us forget it. We can remember again that we are the soil. Work with ecosystems, with life, with the soil and with the seed. And the new knowledge that's coming about how every little root hair in the soil is the neuron of the plant communicating all the time with the living soil. How in our gut are this amazing microbiome, which is being killed by the Roundup and the Roundup ready crops. That the Roundup is killing all the beneficial organisms in the soil and then leading to pathogenic organisms. That is being empty-brained. To not realize that health of the soil and our health comes from the living diversity, both within us and on the planet. So as the age of oil ends, and it won't end by itself, we'll have to work with a lot of love, a lot of compassion, a lot of hope, but a lot of fun and a lot of joy. It's time to stop thinking of climate change through fear. It's time to start thinking of climate change as an opportunity the earth has given us to return to our roots, to return to the soil. And as more and more of us make that shift, the age of oil will be unstoppable. I will leave you with a quotation from one of our ancient Vedas, which we've quoted in Terra Viva, the manifesto on our soil, our commons, our future. A new vision for planetary citizenship. This new vision is also an ancient vision. And the Vedas say, upon this handful of soil, our survival depends. Husband it, and it will grow our food, our fuel, and our shelter, and surround us with beauty. Abuse it, and the soil will collapse and die, taking humanity with it. We should be around as a species 2,000 years down the line. for people to say, in time, our ancestors woke up. Thank you.
That was the inspiring finale of the keynote address by the Indian ecologist, physicist, and seed collector, Vandana Shiva. She spoke at the Soil Not Oil Conference in Richmond, California, on September 4, 2015. Industrial agriculture is a major cause of greenhouse gas emissions that bring about climate change. Vandana Shiva and others are now making the case that restoring the soil and recovering organic agriculture around the world can not only dramatically limit climate change, but even has the capacity to sequester carbon back into the soil. She's the author of many books, among them Earth Democracy, Monoculture of the Mind, The Violence of the Green Revolution, and Making Peace with the Earth. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, www.tucradio.org. Look at the newest programs or the podcast page. While you're there, you can subscribe to weekly free podcasts. Downloads are free, and we appreciate any size donation to keep TUC Radio on the air. TUC Radio takes its name from an aeronautical term. Time of useful consciousness is the time between the beginning of oxygen deficiency and the loss of consciousness, the brief moment in which a pilot may save the plane. My name is Maria Gleiden. Thank you for listening.
You're listening to Latin Waves with your hosts, Sylvia and Stuart Richardson. Latin Waves is more than just hot rhythms. This is a show about community, about creating a culture that is inclusive and based on fairness. Because everyone deserves dignity, respect, and has something to contribute. A new world is possible, and it all starts with us.
Capitalism does not have any duration. It does not exist outside our activity. If capitalism exists today, it's not because it was created 100 or 200 years ago. If capitalism exists today, it is because people are producing it today.
Welcome to this week's edition of Latin Waves. We speak to John Holloway, author of Crack Capitalism and Changing the World Without Taking Power. He speaks about the role of the individual in perpetuating a system based on capital and consumption. As John puts it, the question we should be asking ourselves is not how do we defeat capitalism, but why do we keep reproducing it every day?
John Holloway is the author of Crack Capitalism, Change the World Without Taking Power. He's also the author of Zapatista, Rethinking Revolution in Mexico and Global Capital, National State and Politics of Money. Thank you very much for joining us today. Now, in your book, Crack Capitalism, your latest book, you argue that radical change can only come about through creation, the creation and expansion and multiplication of cracks in the capitalist system. Can you give us an example of how an average person create cracks in this system?
I think we do it all the time, in fact. As a way into talking about that, there was something that really caught my attention in the email that you sent me, where at the bottom of the email, and I suppose at the bottom of all the emails that you send, there's a quotation from Arundhati Roy, which says, "Another world is not only possible, she is on her way. On the quiet day, I can hear her breathing." I mean, that seems to me an absolutely beautiful quotation. I didn't know it at all. But it seems to me that that is what I'm trying to do in the book, to listen to the breathing of this other world, this other possible world. And I think that breathing is actually something that is present in all of us and present in our everyday lives. So I think central part of my argument is really that there is nothing special about being anti-capitalist, that we are all anti-capitalist in one way or another. I mean, some of us are very committed and conscious of being anti-capitalist. Others just see it in terms of decency, in terms of love, in terms of the way, the sort of way we want to relate to the people around us. So you can think of this other world that is breathing. You can think of it, say, in terms of the Zapatistas, who were very, on a very big scale and a very clear project to actually create another world here and now. But you can also think of it in terms of a gardener. I mean, somebody who just cultivates a garden in order to create a different world with a different relationship with the plants. I mean, a relationship with other forms of life that goes against the dreadful destruction of life that capitalism implies. One of the things that I say at the beginning is really that the book is the story of many, many people, of millions, perhaps billions. It is the story of the composer in London who expresses his anger and his dream of a better society through the music he composes. It is the story of the gardener in Cholula who creates a garden to struggle against the destruction of nature, of the car worker in Birmingham who goes in the evenings to his garden allotment so that he has some activity that is meaning and pleasure for him, of the indigenous peasants in Ovantik Chiapas who create an autonomous space of self-government and defend it every day against the paramilitaries who harass them, of the university professor in Athens who creates a seminar outside the university framework for the promotion of critical thought, of the friends in Porto Alegre who form a choir just because they enjoy singing, of the theater director in Vienna who decides she will use her skills to open a different world to those who see her plays, of the radio presenter in Vancouver, I could have added, who creates a program in order to open up other types of discussion that go against the logic of capitalism, of the people who just try and create relations with the people around them that don't follow the logic of money, that don't follow the logic of profit. And if you think of anti-capitalism in that way, you begin to see that really all the time we're trying to break with this logic that we know is destroying the world and that we feel all the time as something oppressive and alien. So that these kind of little spaces or little moments I call cracks, because they seem to be cracks in the logic of capitalist development. The processes of negation and creation, processes in which we say, no, we don't want capital. We want to create something else. So it's really going beyond shouting against the capitalists and trying to create, begin to create the other world that we so desperately need. But we don't do it, seems to me, on a big scale. We do it sometimes on a big scale, but lots of times we do it on a small, very small scale, just with friends, say, creating a community garden. And sometimes we just, they're not necessarily cracks in space. They can be cracks in time. You know, now in the half hour of this interview, or however long we take, you know, our concern is really, how do you bring to life this other world that we can hear breathing? How do we nurture it? How do we create something different? Not how do we make money for the next half hour, no, but how do we go in a different logic? And I suppose that most of your listeners are really thinking in the same terms. The book is about how you can hear the breathing of the other world through these cracks, through these different moments of negation and creation. But not only that, also to think about the problems that they face, because you know, although it's clear that these cracks are very inspiring and very exciting, it's also very clear that they have very big problems, precisely because they run counter to the logic of capitalist development. So I'm trying to think, on the one hand, kind of sing a song of praise, I suppose, for the cracks, and on the other hand, to think, yeah, we mustn't romanticize them too much, because they are within the context of a capitalist society that is running on a mad chase towards the destruction of humanity altogether. So how do we actually think about that clash between the two logics? And how do we nurture and give strength to the cracks that begin to open a different world?
Invariably, people are kind of associating capitalism with freedom and democracy. And this problem with using the language interchangeably really troubles me, because I don't think that this is the case. I think that the language has been co-opted. And when we talk about freedom, we are talking about choices. We're talking about market choices. And within a choice based society, those with more money have more choices. Those with wealth have power to decide, and the rest of us are not invited to the table to make decisions. So I wonder if you could focus on the myths that sustain capitalism. What are some of those myths, and what prevents us from looking beyond creating something new and imagining, as you point out, using our creativity to imagine something new?
I think that possibly the strongest myth that sustains capitalism is simply the idea that there isn't any alternative, that we can't, that the idea that we can't change it. And it just seems to me so obvious now that capitalism is an absolute disaster. I mean, it's an absolute disaster, not only because of the way in which it creates great inequalities, but I mean, we all know now, I think, that if we don't break with capitalism, then it is very, very likely that the human life will not last for very long. I mean, we know what capitalism and its dynamic is doing to nature, to the natural preconditions of our own existence. We know the sort of violence that it's creating. We know the inequality. We know the stress that we live through at work every day. Okay, I mean, they're kind of myths of freedom and democracy, but we know also that the political system is a farce. We know that elections are not going to change things radically. We know that freedom is limited by money, that it's a farcical freedom. I suppose what I feel is perhaps what we should do is think that really, most of us know that capitalism is a disaster. What we don't see is the existence of alternatives, and the existence of alternatives not only are not so much in terms of great revolutions, but the existence of alternatives in the way in which we do things every day. I mean, if we go out for a meal with friends, for example, right? This is in many ways normally an anti-capitalist process. I mean, not in the sense that we're going to steal the food. I mean, maybe we will, but that's not what I was thinking of. Just in the sense that we sort of discuss together democratically, well, what type of food would we like? Where will we go to eat? What time will we meet? And so on. I mean, that kind of push towards self-determination is actually part, a very deep part of our everyday lives. And it is something that runs counter to the determination of decisions by money and by profit. My feeling is that really left discourse much of the time concentrates too much on denouncing capitalism. I think that is important. I mean, I think it is important all the time to say what an awful system it is and how unjust, and to point it out in detail. But I think perhaps it's more important at the stage at which we're at the moment, it's more important to say, well, yeah, I mean, capitalism is just an awful system. Capitalism is our suicide. What are we going to do about it? Can no longer think in terms of revolution in 50 years' time. That's silly. What are we going to do about it now? How do we come out of capitalism now? How do we nurture this other society, or, you see, or other world that we can hear breathing, according to the quotation from Arundhati Roy?
One of the key components that you're describing about an alternative is to begin asking the question, if we're not going to be organized in a hierarchical way where we're abiding to some political official or someone who is elected, and by that we dismiss our own responsibility, then I guess what you're proposing is to create something where we're horizontally organized and also equally responsible for the outcomes of whatever we put in place. And the biggest obstacle to seeing a world that's not based on a hierarchy and a structure of dominance of, you know, men over women or of manager over worker, etc., is usually the idea that we can possibly organize ourselves and be able to resolve conflicts if we're all equal. How do we bridge that gap then? Because that's another, I think, obstacle that we face. That we've been so accustomed to seeing ourselves in this hierarchy, seeing the person at the top as having this almost unchallenged authority, and we give legitimacy without questioning. Why? Why do we do that? You know, and could we do it differently?
I suppose three answers occur to me. Firstly, the example I gave a moment ago, I mean, just look at our own lives and look at the way we decide things in lots and lots and lots of instances is not hierarchical. We actually have a daily practice of horizontalism. We have a daily practice of trying to find common solutions together. Secondly, I think if you look at the social movements, or the anti-capitalist movements, especially of the last 15, 20 years, before that as well, but it's become an important theme of the last 15, 20 years. If you look at the Zapatista movement in Chiapas, if you look at the uprising in Argentina at the beginning of the decade, if you look at movements all around the world and the way in which they are placing emphasis on developing different sorts of forms of organization precisely to encourage people to participate fully or to articulate their views fully, to reach decisions that we all share, then I think you can learn from that experience, I mean, just how well horizontal decision-making can work or does work in the vast majority of cases. And the third point, I think, is simply that we can't go, I mean, it's clear we can't go on the way we're going. Now, if we go on the way we're going, it's really quite likely that that we'll destroy the world or destroy human life on the world. In some sense, we have to assume our own responsibility for the future of humanity. You know, we can no longer say, well, it's the responsibility of the leaders, it's the responsibility of the president or the prime minister or the politicians or the leader of the party or the revolutionary leaders. No. When you're kind of faced with catastrophe, then the only possible thing is to take our own responsibility.
What inspires your work?
I suppose what we all see around us is, on the one hand, a system of social cohesion, a kind of coherent system that seems to knit together so logically, so rationally, and so terribly destructively. I mean, that we want to scream. It's difficult to watch the news on television, for example, without wanting to scream. So that's on the one hand. And on the other hand, I suppose what we also see around us really all the time is struggles against this system. Fantastic struggles, lots of times, or just tiny little struggles, which are also fantastic as well. I suppose that's what inspires my work. And then, yeah, obviously just thinking about that and reading about that and reading people who are thinking about that.
I was interviewing Bruce Dixon, and he was talking about how if a corporation were truly human, the corporation VP, for instance, the one responsible for the spill in the Gulf of Mexico, would be now about 120 years. And he points out how these organizations are immortal and their actions are often excluded from the responsibilities of other human beings. So as you're talking about what inspires you, as you're talking about the way we are changing, the way we are struggling, the legacy of resistance, I think about the connection, right? The connection of people becoming awakened to this world that has sort of inverted, co-opted our language and used it against us, you know, where we're giving rights to corporations to pollute and kill people openly, where we're giving a mass industry like militarism the right to use our wealth that we'd like to use for health and education to kill others and bring disaster to the lives of millions in other places, you know, people who have, like us, brothers, sisters, mothers. So it's important that we look at this stage, I think, not only as a turning point, but also as a key catalyst for what moves us to act. In your book, you call us to action. What would you ask people to do? What do you hope will come out of people reading your book?
I'm not sure if I call people to action. I think what I want to do really is for us to recognize that we are already acting in lots of ways. You know, that also things that we consider insignificant are very often the creation or the possible creation of a different world. I suppose what I'm trying to do is say, look, that the answer really lies with ourselves. It lies with ourselves because the problem is not the corporations. The problem is ourselves. The problem is that on the one hand, we are creating capitalism. And on the other hand, we are also trying to do something else. We are creating capitalism because the fundamental problem is not actually capital. The fundamental problem is the labor that creates capital. If you think of these cracks, if you think of this breadth of the other possible world, or these different areas of breathing of the other possible world, then you can see really that they're distinguished by the attempt to create the other hand, we know that we also labor. Most of us have to sell our labor power, our ability to work, to capital in order to produce things that will sell, or in order to promote in some way the conditions of capitalist reproduction. Okay, so we're kind of caught by this bifurcation, if you like, of this antagonism between capitalist labor, the labor of actually producing and reproducing capital on the one hand, and developing an activity that makes sense to us on the other hand. So the way I see the possibility of change, and the way in which I see what's happening at the moment, is in terms of a revolt of doing against labor. I think more and more over the last 15, 20 years, we have come to understand that the struggle against capital is not the struggle of labor against capital. It is, in fact, the struggle against the labor that produces capitalism. In other words, the struggle is to reject the sort of activity that produces the corporations, that produces, of course, the weapons, that produces commodities, and to try and develop an activity that simply that has sense for us, I think. It's an activity that we consider useful or necessary. And I think we're all in that. I mean, you're producing and the host of this program, but you're doing it because this is an activity that has sense to you. I'm a university professor. Okay, in that sense, I sell my labor power and I get paid for it. And I have to go through certain hoops that I hate. But I also try and develop my activity in a way that makes students critical, in a way that I enjoy, in a way in which the focus of teaching and of learning really becomes the question of how we can move on, how we can overcome capital. I assume that all our listeners are caught in this sort of antagonism that actually cuts through us. I mean, we are schizophrenic just by the fact of living in an antagonistic society. We are schizophrenic. So the question of how we strengthen the cracks is the question of how do we strengthen our own doing against labor? How do we actually turn our activity more and more against labor? And that actually takes us into a whole, I mean, part of the argument is that labor brings with it all sorts of things, historically and logically, that labor, or what Marx calls abstract labor, capital-producing labor, brings with it a certain sort of form of sexuality, a certain form of relation to nature, a certain concept of time, a certain certain forms of organization. And that if we try to break that, as we are doing, if we break with that, then what we do is we develop other forms of sexuality, other forms of relation with nature, other concepts of time, other forms of organization. And I think that's what's happening in the anti-capitalist movement at the moment, that there is a kind of a deep shift taking place. And the deep shift is actually has as its axis the rejection of labor and the understanding of anti-capitalism, not as the struggle of labor, but the struggle of a different type of activity. A central point of that is the question of time. Capitalist labor is really tied up very much with the notion of clock time, the idea that time is something outside us, that time is something that moves forward independent of our activity. And that is what gives us the idea that capitalism exists from one day to another. Whereas really the problem is to break that concept of time and to understand that, no, time is not independent of our activity. Capitalism does not have any duration. It does not exist outside our activity. If capitalism exists today, it's not because it was created 100 or 200 years ago. If capitalism exists today, it is because people are producing it today. So that means that the question of of revolution. It is a question of how to break with capitalism. It's not the question of how do we break, how do we abolish something that exists. It is really the question of how do we stop producing capitalism? How do we stop making capitalism? And the only way in which we can stop making capitalism is by creating something else. And I think that, it may sound a very roundabout or complicated way of saying it, but I think that's actually what's happening. I mean, it's really this awareness that it's not the question of building up the great organization. It's not a question of overthrowing the state. That's not revolution. Revolution is actually saying, well, no, we're not going to act in that way. We're not going to labor. We're not going to structure our activity from one day to another in terms of the needs of capital. We are going to do something else. We're going to stop making capital.
For people listening to this, you know, it seems like an alien idea to consider that we create capital by becoming commodified units ourselves, right? By allowing ourselves to become just another form of commodification, the way we made our life available and act in the workplace without a connection to how that impacts all the other aspects of our lives. The Industrial Revolution had this many ideas that, you know, it will bring us leisure, that with all this technology that people would work less. But you're right. Instead, we are producing more. We're constantly producing more that feeds and maintains the structure of capitalism. How can people access your book?
People in charge of the distribution are Fernwood Books.
That's fantastic. Thank you so much for being with us today, John. John Holloway is my guest. He is the author of many books, including, well, his book, Change the World Without Taking Power, Zapatista, Rethinking Revolution in Mexico and Global Capital, National State and the Politics of Money, and his latest book, Crack Capitalism. Thank you again for being with us.
Thank you very much indeed, Sylvia.
Take care.
Thank you.
We have come to the end of our program. Latin Waves is a weekly syndicated program available to campus and community radios. Please visit our website, www.latinwavesmedia.com, to hear previous shows, connect to our media projects, and access other resources, or to support our efforts by making a safe PayPal contribution. I am Sylvia Richardson. Thanks for listening.